Enter. If you dare.
Welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going, sir?
I am fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right, doing all right. And in the state of in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Hi, everyone. This is Abe here.
Abe, how's it going?
All right, it's been a busy week, but I'm doing okay.
Excellent. And a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
I am good. I just had a classic 70s dad dinner of a burger and a black coffee, so I am happy.
Nice, nice. For folks who are curious, today is July 30th, 2020 is the day that we are recording this. For some of our listeners who are curious, since we do not release them the day after, or necessarily a week after, like some podcasts.
Or even in order,
that's right. Yes. Example 447, Sea Fever, was recorded, three or four episodes before it was actually released, and so it was four episodes out of order, technically. So, yes, good point, Eric. We do have an email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, where you can email us your comments, your reviews, or anything else that would interest us, or just critique and whatnot, and we will read your email on the podcast. Also, we have a Facebook group called Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, where you can join, and you can join into the conversation, where there is multitudes of discussions going on there. And we do have a website, darkdiscussions.com. And Eric, well, what can folks find on that website?
Keep an eye out, by the way, because coming soon the website will be revamped. Phil was just before we started recording giving us a preview, and it's all very exciting. But right now, if you look at the front page on the right hand side, you will find links to friends of the podcast. So be sure to visit all of them. Up at the top of the page, you have a articles link that'll take you to articles written by myself as well as other people. There is an audio link that will take you, and in the audio section, you can find every single episode of Dark Discussions ever released, as well as any of the spinoff podcasts available to download for free. There's bound to be something that interests you there, so check that out. On the front center is a link to our Patreon account. Patreon allows you to support your online artists financially. If you care to do so, we greatly appreciate it. For every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly do a show on. We take all the submissions from our patrons, and we draw one at random on a quarterly basis to do a show on. So if you're interested in supporting us in that manner, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com.
Excellent. That's right. That's right. And we just recorded two Patreon episodes. And so they will be coming out shortly. And look out for them as well. That will be The Mothman Prophecies and Dig Two Graves. And we do have a third one up
Candy
and coming.
Man.
Candyman.
Candy Cane.
Yes. So Candyman, the movie, that one. The original one with Tony Todd and Virginia Madsen, that will be an episode shortly.
Yes. However you're holding your head right now, that's how you sound good.
Excellent. All right. That sounds good. I'm using a different mic tonight for those who are curious. All right. So I think we can probably get into our episode tonight, and then, you know, we'll talk about anything and everything after, such as what we've watched and news and so forth, if we have time. But with that, Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we are going to be talking about a 2020 release, M.O.M., Mothers of Monsters, available on Amazon Prime.
My son Jacob, he just turned 16. That's a handful for any kind of mom.
You want a monster out? That's fine. Monster out.
Leave me alone.
I mean, what kind of kid wants to turn his pellet gun into an automatic weapon?
I don't think you should tell anyone.
Chill, Mom. Serious.
Let go. Ow. You're hurting me.
Not even touching you.
Everybody loves the fake Jacob. He doesn't fit the profile.
What are you recording me for?
Kitchen cam. Meet living room cam.
Testing. I am spying on my son. And it's a live feed.
We're gonna look for signs. We're gonna look for patterns. For anything that can help.
Do you feel Jacob is capable of harming you, Abby?
Okay. Hey! Jacob! Stop it now! Now!
What if he hurts someone else?
Hey, Detective Kelly, Mom's freaking out again.
Knock it off.
Are you taking your medications?
Mom? Mom?
Even if I could turn him in, I probably wouldn't. Maybe he'll get better.
He what? Oh my God.
One, two, three, four.
I like your movie.
Got more up there to the next time. Oh, we're no leaders. One shot in a game, more pussy than a pitch. I'm gonna kill the whole team and they let me take shots of a D like Rescue.
I tell you, one fucking day!
Third, when your main girl texts me, she ain't gonna get me. Yeah, okay, I'm the man I am.
911, what's your emergency?
Your mommy loves you.
That's right. M.O.M., Mothers of Monsters, is a 2020 film, as Eric mentioned. It was originally released March 13th, 2020 in the United States, and it's gotten a pretty good buzz on the Facebook horror podcast community that myself, Eric, and the rest of the co-hosts are members of. Me and Eric were the ones that were talking about it first, and that's why it came up as a possible episode. It is a found footage film directed by Tasia Lyman, which I assume that is a woman's name. I'm not too familiar with that Tasia, but I believe it is. And it stars not too many folk, but Sevan Alexanian as a locksmith. But the interesting thing is Ed Asner's last film before he passed away in a small role. And then there is a handful of other folk, but I don't know any of them otherwise except from this film and whatnot. So the film was also written by Tasia Lyman, too. So I guess we can go around and discuss how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. And let's start with you, Chrissy.
Well, I had not heard of this until you told me we were doing it, Phil. And I was really excited to see that it was included with Amazon Prime. That was a nice treat. I am a found footage junkie. I really like found footage films in general. I have certainly seen my share of terrible found footage films. And I don't even mind the terrible ones so much. I didn't know what to expect going into this. However, I really enjoyed this. In terms of found footage, I thought it was fresh. It was different. I thought it was an interesting take on the idea of the bad seed, which is a trope that we see pretty frequently in horror, in the horror genre. But this takes a completely different take on it. I thought the acting was very good. I liked how it kind of messed with your head. There definitely does seem to be an unreliable narrator, because that is one of the big things about found footage films, is because we are seeing them from one person's first person point of view, basically. It would be the same as the eye in a short story. You never really know, like, if what you're seeing is true, even though you are seeing it through a camera. And supposedly the camera is telling you the truth. So there's a very interesting sort of Veritas thing going on. And in this movie, what's interesting about it is we're kind of getting two different points of view. And I liked being strung along so that even at the end, I really wasn't sure. I really wasn't sure who was crazy and who was not. And I really enjoyed that very much. I think the script was tight. I did have a couple of logistical issues with it from a found footage point of view. But other than that, I really enjoyed this. I thought it was a ride. I think it does have something to say, for sure. And it does kind of, it has an edge to it in that it kind of touches on some very heavy issues in our society with relation to gun violence and school shootings. And so that may, it, for those people out there, those listeners who are sensitive to that, this might not be the movie for you. I really, really liked it. So I give it my stamp of approval, especially if you like found footage and you're looking for a decent found footage film to watch. I'm not going to say it's the greatest found footage I've ever seen, but it's, I enjoyed it. It was good. Worth my time.
All right. Very good. That's interesting that you brought that up, Chrissy, about the type of film it is, because if you go to Amazon Prime and you watch the film, it says, if you like this film, you may like these films. And we need to talk about Kevin was one of the films that was listed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Let's go with Eric.
I can't remember where I first heard about this. It might have been on the WotC Horror Party show, where they go through new releases every month. And I think this came up in their list of new releases some month. And it sounded interesting. So I decided to check it out. And I'm glad I did. Like everything Chrissy just said, I can't argue with much of it. I thought that, I mean, this is basically, there are other minor characters that pop in and out, but it's basically a two-person show. And I thought the two main characters that play a mother and a son were great. They did a really good job. There's an interesting aspect of the movie that I'm interested to discuss with my co-hosts, but I'm not sure if all of us will be able to discuss it. Because there's a post-credit scene, and I don't know if everybody watched past the credits. So, that being said, if you're into found footage, yeah, absolutely check this one out. It's a little bit weird to find, I noticed, because it's M.O.M.Mothers of Monsters is the title of the movie. And in some places, if you just type in M.O.M., nothing comes up. But then if you complete it with Mothers of Monsters, it shows. So be aware of that if you're looking for it. I give it a recommend.
All right, very good. Let's go,
Eric. Just before we go on about the searching, I had trouble finding it. The way that I found it was I typed in "Mothers of Monsters movie" and it popped right up. So that might be a shortcut in case anybody's wondering.
Cool.
Nice. All right, Mike.
Yeah, I don't think I'd heard of the movie until last week when it came up for the podcast. I was trying to figure out what it was about. At first, I thought I was a little excited because it might be something about monsters. And I remembered Phil recommended it, and he doesn't like supernatural stuff. So it was probably about mothers of serial killers or something along those lines. And that tended to be fairly accurate. This is you kind of stepped on the joke I was going to use, which is that this is we need to talk about Mother. It's very much in that vein. I watched it with my wife Pam the other night, and yeah, she pointed out, "Hey, this is kind of like reminds me of we need to talk about Kevin." So it is kind of about that, about the relationship between a mother and her potentially psychotic son. That's the big difference. We need to talk about Kevin occurs after the event and cuts back and forth between the time before the tragedy and the life of the of Kevin, the child, and what the mother is dealing with after the tragedy. In this case, we don't know that the tragedy is going to occur or it's being set up. I think it tips its hand a little too early as to the twist in the film, as to what's going to happen. But other than that, I liked it. It's kind of, as found footage goes, I'd put it maybe like along the lines of, say, a Paranormal Activity, in that it's not, it's about a lot of camera, and maybe, was it, what was that one, what was the one that came out a couple years ago with the missing girl?
Megan Is Missing.
Oh, Megan Is Missing.
Yeah. No, not that one. We did it on the podcast.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about. The found footage with the chick that was in the Mothman's Prophecies, the wife of Richard Gere. What's her name?
Laura Linney?
No, the other woman, the redhead that was played his wife.
I'm totally lost. I got no idea what
you're talking about. It's about it's this like Asian guy is dying.
Yeah.
Is
searching.
Searching.
Searching. Yeah. Oh, okay. Right. Oh, okay. My God. So, right. So good.
So it's using a lot of spoken footage to a webcam and seeing things from fixed cameras within a house. So this isn't like Blair Witch that Korean film we did a couple of years ago where you're following people with handheld cameras. Right. So it's more of a station, more multiple stationary cams and a little bit voyeuristic, faux documentary almost, because the idea here is that the mother is putting together a sort of a catalog or a diary for any mothers that are potentially dealing with the same issue for them to watch, because nobody will listen to her. Because Kevin, not Kevin, was it Jesse? Jacob.
Jacob, yeah.
Jacob is his name.
Yep. Yes, Jesse was the uncle. Is just too smart for them. So other than that, I liked it. It is not nearly as emotionally devastating as, or I think grounded or as complex as We Need to Talk About Kevin is. But that's a really, really, really high bar to have to hurt pass here. You know. So I liked it. I would recommend it. I understand some people loathe found footage, so don't watch it then. But for those who are just in found footage, I would definitely, or at least open to it, I would certainly give it a shot.
All right. Very good. Yeah, for me, back on April 15th on the Dark Discussions podcast Facebook group, which everyone should join, I wrote a post that said 2020 is turning into a good horror or quasi-horror film year. A lot of good stuff. And then folks began commenting underneath. And people like Jamie Sammons and Jason Lloyd and Don Anelli and Heather Powell and Garrett, David Michigan Garrett. I'm sorry?
And the rest of the internet.
Yeah. Well, for some reason, that post got a lot of comment feed. And a lot of those folks all mentioned MOM as a film of interest, because they were listing films that they thought were pretty good in 2020 by the time April came around as well, and MOM was one of them. So I watched it back then and thought it was pretty decent, and then kind of forgot about it, but I wasn't overwhelmed. But rewatching it this week with my wife, she liked the trailer. I thought it was awesome on the second viewing, and it is a top-notch found footage film. Very, very sad and depressing, as my wife mentioned to me, but really good and excellent thriller. Mike mentioned it has no supernatural, and that's true, which made it more interesting for me, though I do like supernatural, just not as much as real world horror. Our real world horror films. I would give it a big thumbs up. Definitely recommend a quick hour and 30 minutes or so. And then, as Eric mentioned, there's something at the end that I hadn't seen after the post credits. So even though there's a long credit scene, I guess there's something to see at the very end. So it's a total of 1 hour and 38 minutes or so. But yeah, I would definitely recommend it. And another small indie film that a lot of folks may not have heard of that should probably check it out, especially now that you can get it on Amazon Prime for free if you're a subscriber to Amazon Prime. Abe?
I think I heard about this movie a while back, but I had never really watched it until, you know, recently. So today was the first time I actually viewed the film. And I did enjoy it. I think it was a well-made film. I was really cool how they did the entire thing with different forms of recording equipment, whether it's handheld cameras or security cameras and stuff like that. I thought that was really interesting. The performances were really strong too. I definitely agree with that sentiment. It's a very tragic story. I won't go into any details until you go into the spoiler section of this episode, but it's a very tragic story. I think it might. There's little bits here and there I was a little mixed on, but I do think it was also tackled on a topic that should be talked about in regards to the mental illness dilemma that our country is facing. It's not just us, because, you know, not only that, school violence and how our kids are raised in this, these days. It definitely has a lot to say, especially it puts up an emergency number for such a mental illness and such problems. So it is trying to talk about an issue. It's trying to ignite a conversation. Hell, even the ending song is about what it wants to get across. It's a good film, and I definitely think it was a good choice because there is certainly a lot to break down and look at. So, yeah, I'm glad I watched it.
All right, very good. So, the entire internet that I listed out a little while ago that Eric mentioned, it appears that we all at least liked it. Just as they did. Eric, do we have an IMDb wiki?
Yes. A distraught mother suspects her teenage son is plotting a school shooting, but when he slips through the cracks of the system, she is forced to take matters into her own hands.
All right, very well. That's kind of odd, because I don't think she ever mentions shooting. When Chrissy mentioned shooting in her little review, I thought that was interesting because I don't think they mention gun violence at all during
the film. Oh, yes, they do.
They do.
Yeah, he goes to the gun shop.
Yeah, well, he looks at it, but he didn't go in. But yeah,
well, there's also, Phil, not to be spoilery, but it would have been easy to miss. There is one section where she's like in, I don't know, her garage or her laundry, her outdoor laundry room or something, and she's talking about something that he kind of went through 2 years ago, and she found this map of the school, and
yeah,
he had
true.
Drawn yep. himself in it, and that's kind
for
of
scale.
Where... Yeah,
for
scale.
Scale.
Yeah,
and
he actually...
Talks
yeah,
about,
and the bodies and stuff mixed out around the
yeah,
hall and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Why she... That's
and
why
he, she... And he had, like... Armies of Fortune magazine, you know, guns and ammo magazine and stuff like that.
So right, and he was buying. Was it a laser? No, he was buying a bump. Was looking at a bump stock.
Yeah,
that's right. That's true. Yeah,
bought for
yeah.
an air gun for an air.
Yeah,
pistol.
Yeah. Actually, when I was a little kid, like 15 or whatever, 14, I bought a Guns and Ammo magazine and brought it home because I was going to use it for Top Secret, which was one of those TSR Dungeons and Dragons company.
I had a copy of that game.
Yeah, that was a great game. And so I wanted all these new guns and stuff to use in it. And my mother made me return the magazine because she goes, we ain't having that guns in it. So, yeah. So I guess, I was doing it for a different reason than he was. But, yeah, all right, that's a fair point. Now, before we get into the film, we're going to critique and review and spoil it and all that, but we can talk about general things about mental illness, as Abe was bringing up, gun violence, parent-child relationships, and all that. So, in other words, stuff that's non-spoilery to the actual film before we do get into the spoiler territory, which we will notify everybody when we do that. Yeah, let me ask you this, folks. Originally, yeah, I thought he was insane for sure, but when I was watching it the second time, I was at one point doubted if he actually did have a dissocial personality disorder, specifically borderline personality disorder, until the rats or his pets, what happened to his pets, what he did to his pets. And that's when I said, okay, he's gone. Also, another thing that was interesting, too, is that it appears that it runs in the family, this dissocial personality disorder, because of an uncle, maybe his own mother had some issues and is on medication to keep her in check. So, there's a lot of behavioral health individuals in this film, I think.
You think?
I think. Wackadoodles. I think, yeah.
Well, I think there's a couple of different issues that this film does try to deal with, and I think one of them certainly is, mental health and some developmental disabilities as well. But also, it tends to frame them in, like you said, Phil, it's genetic, in the fact that it runs in families and that it's passed down. And we don't get the idea that the grandmother is too well adjusted either, from just the one exchange that we see her in. She doesn't appear to be...
she's willfully ignorant.
Together. Yeah. Yeah, but see, that's an interesting thing, because... there are, in older generations, certainly people that just deny that. That was a common thing. You didn't talk about the family crazy. You
right.
Know what
well,
I mean?
And it was her son, right? Her son, the uncle of Jacob, that had some issues as well. So you're right. It's she definitely was trying to ignore the thing, even though it was interesting, because when she wanted to ignore it, she ignored it or played dumb, but then she was the one that was saying to the mother, whose name is Abby, are you on your medication? You're still taking it, right? So she was concerned enough and aware enough that she probably knew that her daughter may have some problems if she doesn't take her own medicine. That was an interesting thing.
Well, we also see she's very, very concerned about appearance, right? The first time we see her is she's worried about lipstick for a webcam conversation with her daughter.
Right.
But even before that, she talks about that with her son, right? Is that she, doesn't want to look bad or has to protect his record or something like that. She's talking about how things look rather than what, her grandson's actual mental health.
Right.
Or the consequences of anything that he might do. Really she's she doesn't care if there's actually a problem as long as nobody else knows there's a problem.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, I don't remember who was on the podcast for the We Need to Talk About Kevin episode.
I was.
Okay, I think the reality is most people don't see their child, however fucked up their child might be, they don't foresee their child doing that, right? Which is, you just dismiss it. They're troubled, they have a problem, but they're not a psychopath. They're not a murderer. They're not going to go shoot up a school. I mean, the other option, of course, are those people who just automatically assume their child is the worst possible thing, but they're a different type of parent.
Well, and Mike, to be fair, I think that's changed in recent history. Certainly nobody thought about that through the 90s.
Right.
Since Columbine, it seems to become a fact of life. And so perhaps parents are thinking about that more now than they did prior.
Well, and even it's interesting because there is that moment where, and I'm going to try not to be spoilery here, but when Abby, the mother, talks about he doesn't exhibit any of the usual signs of a school shooter. Like she literally says, he has friends and he's, so I think there's a level of denial, but I also think one of the other issues that this film addresses, which we can talk about a little later also, is just, how difficult it is to be not only a single mother, but how difficult it is, I think, to be a mother in general, because you do have a lot of doubt. You do have a lot of fear. You do wonder. You love this thing that you brought into the world, but you're constantly afraid that you screwed up. You're constantly afraid that, you know, your child is going to have not just mental, but maybe physical, you know, issues too, illnesses that are inherited. I think this film really kind of, and that's why I thought that was one of the things I really admired about this, is that it kind of touched on the very universal issue of being a mom, where these mothers really are concerned about, what is my kid going to be like? I mean, you know, did I screw this up? Should I have done this in the first place? I think that is something that faces, I think it faces men too, when they become fathers. I just think that this movie chose to address the maternal side of it rather than the paternal side of it. But I think it addresses a very valid universal issue, and how sometimes when you're, child does something bad, you know, you're freaking pissed at them. Like, there's a point where she's like, dude, I hate him. Like, you know, and these feelings are normal. And I think these are feelings that they do address them a little bit in the Kevin movie. But I think in terms of actually putting a spotlight on it, I think this film puts a spotlight on that kind of fear and unrest and anxiety and uncertainty in a very specific way. Yeah.
Well, especially in this case, it especially addressed the very fact that our main character is contending with, has contended with something similar before the events of the film. So she's already still dealing with the trauma of something that had happened previously. We'll get into more of that as we go along, but it just kind of shows that, you know, how these fears and these old wounds of these kind of situations can linger in families. And
go on. Are you finished?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add that. With this film here, they talk about how, or Abby talks about how she went to children, some sort of government thing about trying to get her son tested for a dissocial personality disorder, mental illness, whatever. And they told her that there was no issues or whatnot. Again, a lot of sociopaths can trick people and hide their illness to questionnaires anyway. But if we didn't have that statement at the beginning of the film, for the first 40 minutes or so, I don't know if I would have considered him a possible bad kid in the sense that we're talking about in this film. In other words, the things he did, some of it were rotten, but they were just rotten. They weren't like, he wasn't like evil. I mean, the only thing that he did evil in the first 40 minutes of the film, really evil, I felt, was dropping the brick
into traffic.
But again,
and even that
stupid,
and that is right, can just be, and see, that's another issue that I think comes with being a single mom. No offense to single moms here, but you're trying to understand a teenage boy, and teenage boys are fucking corrupt shitheads in a lot of ways.
It's true. I may have done things similar to throwing bricks into traffic.
Yeah.
Right. Teenage boys have a fascination with things that are violent. And it is, I'm sorry, it's a testosterone thing. It's not entirely a social thing. It's a truism around the world. And I don't want to be gender biased. Teenage girls can be sick fucks too, but just in a completely...
Violence and booze.
Right. So it helps to have, when possibly, having a guy around, having a father around or a man around, you know, to say, you know what, it is normal for a teenage boy to be obsessed with guns. It is normal for a teenage boy to be buying gun magazines. And you know, is would be useful, right? As opposed to saying it's not normal for a teenage boy to be electrocuting rats.
And one thing I noticed, unless I missed something, is that we know that she's a single mom and the dad's not around anymore, but I don't think they specifically spell out why the dad's not around anymore. Because when the movie opens, the very first thing you see is a home video of Jacob when he was a little kid, like 8 or something. When the mother is talking to him, but she's talking about her yep. and husband. Did you blah, blah, blah. He's asking him questions saying, we want to know. And I'm assuming, well, I guess I'm making an assumption that we is her and the father.
No, and, it is because you hear the father's voice on there.
Yeah, so also the father's takes he was supposed to go visit the father for the weekend, you remember?
Right. But what they don't spell out, and I'm curious,
is why?
It's something that I'm filling in my brain, and I'm curious if the writer had an explanation in mind, is whether the dad left because the mom, he thought the mom had mental issues, or whether he left because of what happened with the kid, or whether he left because the mom was obsessed with thinking there was something wrong with the kid. That was all left kind of up in the air.
I don't think
it was consequential to the film, because I think since it wasn't a plot device or a plot point, it must have been just the typical divorce. You know, it wasn't specifically because of her.
Well,
it wasn't specifically because of the son.
Actually,
it could have been the guy had a secretary, he cheated on her, or maybe he. You know, we just don't know. I don't think it.
What I kind of took from that, Eric, was that it was a combination of both.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get any.
I almost kind of looked at this, I'm going to just bring it up anyway, because when the Sandy Hook school shooting happened, it was the mother and the kid. Both of them were troubled, and the father had taken the other son and left them.
Right,
so
but it wasn't
that
explained in this film, though.
No, but I mean, that's just how I filled in the blanks. I just assumed it was both of them, because the father didn't really seem
That's not
you know.
The father in this film, even though we never see him, was going to take the son for the entire week or weekend, and
just
then the son just blew him off and blew everybody off. But
right, they don't give us anything
that says that the marriage was dysfunctional or there was a reason specific for the divorce.
I'm saying. There was no specific reason stated, and I'm just strictly conjecturing. I'm just wondering about it. That's all.
Informing based on real events, because this is I'll talk about it later, but the film is kind of drawing off of real life events, right?
Yes.
So
yeah.
So it is not a reach, I'll say that, you know. To make that inference.
Right,
yeah,
but there's nothing
it was both
in the
of them,
film.
That's all.
There's nothing in the film that says that inference should be inferred.
That's how I opened up my whole thing, Phil.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how I agree.
I said was that was the answer that I chose for myself, because to me that made complete sense. I'm like, oh, he took off on them because they're both nuts. Okay, that was how I explained it. I didn't need the film to tell me that.
I think this is intentional, because it's trying to leave up, you leave you questioning who really has the issues.
Yes, that's the whole. That's
and
why.
That's the crux on which this movie rests. Right.
Is
not knowing which one is actually the wackadoodle or.
I want to say that actually I think they did a very good job of parceling out information. They avoided the as you know Bobs, you know
yep.
as you know, you were Jacob when your father and I broke up 4 years ago. So you don't know how long they've been divorced. You don't or separated. You don't know
why. I don't know why.
So we do know, if I remember correctly, you know, having been a full 48 hours since I've seen it, they do mention like this is a change in Jacob's behavior and the son's behavior. So you do have that question: is this just puberty, or is there something wrong with him?
Well, but no,
I disagree. Did they say that?
Too. No, I disagree. And here's why I disagree with that, Mike. Because, you know, we have it where the movie opens where she's like, did you mean to hurt it? Did you mean to whatever?
Oh, okay, like, that's right.
Right. But then there's a couple of other things in there which also led me to believe before we get the drips and drabs of information about the mother's perhaps unstable psychological state for other reasons, there are many references in old footage to this kid being a problem.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, and the therapy, well, right, with the drawings.
Well, it's beyond that,
and,
though.
And
she
the footage
says,
of him on the couch taking a nap saying, sleeping
nap,
Jacob is my favorite Jacob.
Favorite Jacob.
Right. Okay.
And that he threw a fit for 2.5 hours straight. Now, throwing a violent fit for 2.5 hours straight for however old that kid was, that's kind of not really normal. Where
again,
you can't calm the kid down.
This is an unreliable narrator and a mother that's pulling out her hair, so we don't know if it was really 2 hours. This is what she's saying, and all those videos that she showed, or I should say Jacob is watching of himself as a child, you take four of them and it looks bad, but it's just four in an entire child's life. So for example, throwing mud at a little girl, it's like, who hasn't done that as a little kid, throwing mud at another kid?
It could be cherry picking.
Right, or when he's at the bird house and the bird mother's going crazy, it's like, who hasn't, you know, looked at a bird house or a nest and birds, you know, you shouldn't be doing it.
My only point about those, Phil, though, which does, I mean, I'm totally in agreement with you, but what was interesting about it was, yes, she could have been cherry picking so that she slanted her own story, and I get that, and that's part of the great unreliable narrator of this. However, it is clear, I think, that even from the little pieces that we get, that the pieces of Jacob behaving badly are not normal. There is a reason that they are screaming at that little kid to get away from the birdhouse. There's a reason. They're afraid he's going to do something.
Oh, yeah. Kristen,
that's totally obvious. Yeah.
There's actually also a point where they're actually trying to ask young Jacob, what did he mean to hurt something?
I mentioned that earlier.
I'm sorry. I must have missed that. He's acting either oblivious or he doesn't understand what he did was wrong. And,
right, but we're talking about a 6-year-old, so he's
And also, this is the family where they had the uncle go nuts and kill people, so they may be asking those questions for that reason.
I guess we're throwing up the spoiler flag.
Sorry.
I thought we were.
Well,
had.
But the other thing too is that it is very clear from Jacob's young age that this mother, he doesn't respect his mother. She keeps saying to him, even when he's little, don't do this, don't do that, don't you throw that mud. And the kid just doesn't care. Mm-hmm. Like, it seems like she threatens the punishment. Maybe she does not follow through on her parenting threats, and he's used to that. I mean, we don't know that part.
It could be the problem that he's a normal child, that's normal behavior in a child if you have a particular type of mother as well, right? The discipline has no effect.
Correct.
So
and all those things aren't dastardly evil either. They're just a kid being a stinker, you know, throwing mud at another kid, you know, don't do it. And, you know, they're about to do it anyway. And then they finally do it. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
but it was escalating, Phil.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think part of it could have been too that her fears of, you know, her own son displaying the same problems might have created a smothering and a very overly restrictive lifestyle that maybe perhaps that's part of the reason why Jacob rebels so much, because he's now at the age before his life was so completely controlled. Now he's lashing out and doing everything he can to break free of control and everything like that.
And also the mother at this point doesn't give him the benefit of doubt of anything, so I think she's part of the problem too, because, I mean, again, he's a teenager, so he's going to say to hell with mother and to hell with adults or whatever.
Yeah, but he's not a normal teenager. He's a little over the edge.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the way that he talks to his mother and, like, flips her off and the way he fucks with her, like he,
oh yeah,
he is definitely fucked up. I just suspect that for me, it's probably a combination of genetics and the fact that because the mother is psychologically compromised, she can't discipline her kid. So I think it's really a combination of both things, actually.
Well, this is always the problem of separating the environment and the genetics, right? If you're not dealing with adopted children, is the fact that he may have a genetic predisposition towards sociopathy, and then being raised by a mother who is mentally unbalanced may just make it that much worse.
Yeah.
Right? May push him further in that direction. Well, but the whole reason I mentioned this, if I can, before, was simply that what first with them, when I was mentioning with them parceling out information slowly, Pam and I were both wondering if maybe, because you're talking about Jesse, if like Jesse was in fact the father at first. And then
they don't reveal that for a while.
Yeah, and then we don't reveal who Jesse was, and then even after we find out it's the brother, we're like, well, it could have been an incest thing. And then, you know, you find out that she was 12 at the time, she's 42, and Jesse is not 30. Jacob is not 30, so clearly that wasn't the case.
Jerry. The brother's name was Jerry, not Jesse.
Right, but I'm saying Jacob is, what, 16? So this is something that this was an incident that happened 30 years ago, so that clearly wasn't the case. So when they first mentioned Jesse, I was wondering, okay, is that the father? Right, and so they're good at doing this in dribs and drabs. They do give you all the information, but they do it in what mostly feels like natural conversations and not like the forced artificial exposition dump.
And I just want to rewind quick for a sec because you kind of ran right past a point I wanted to key on there, Mike. You were talking about discipline and single moms disciplining their teenage boys. And when I was a teenage boy, I will straight up own the fact that I was a complete asshole and did a lot of shitty things to my single mom. And one of the shitty things, you know, that I did was just not do my chores. I wouldn't mow the lawn. I wouldn't take out the garbage. I wouldn't do any of that. And one of my other friend's moms, when she was walking by one day and my mother was mowing the lawn, said to her, "Why don't you make Eric do that?" And my mom looked at her and goes, "Well, you have a husband around the house to keep your son in line. How he's 4 inches taller than me now. How am I supposed to make him do anything?"
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be sexist and say that you need to have a man around the house, but at the same time, having an equal physical presence around the house could help with discipline issues, and that might be part of the dynamic.
You know, it's funny, Eric, my wife brought that up when we were watching the film, saying, why doesn't she have him do this and that? And I go, to be honest, if he was my son, he'd probably beat the fuck out of me, too. You know, so, I mean, I said, thank God we have two daughters, even though they're going to be hell at 16, but at least they aren't going to beat us up, you know, so... It's I mean, what do you do in today's day and age when
you've got a personality in a man-sized body? The physical strength becomes an issue.
Yeah, right. And you can't throw them out. You can't spank them. So it's like if they don't listen to you, there's nothing you can do. I mean, there really isn't.
Right.
And I think that's one of the reasons why she reported him to Children's Services 2 years earlier, before the film started, was because she needed help because she couldn't do it. And this was when he was 14. So, yeah, I mean, it's a tough situation for a man or a father, never mind a single mother. So it's like, what do you do? Yeah, it's crazy. All right, at this point, let's just throw up the spoiler alert because
spoiler time, folks.
You know, we'll just talk about anything and everything at this point. So if you want to go see the film, it's MOM, Mothers of Monsters. Just search for Mothers of Monsters film, as Chrissy said, and it'll appear on Amazon Prime at least on July 30th, 2020. Who knows how long it'll be there. But either way, you can probably VOD it. All right, so let's talk about anything and everything. So don't worry about any spoilers if something comes up.
So just real quick, I just want to say that one of my favorite moments in the entire movie was at the very end, when she gets out of the closet, and she's going to town, and he just starts laughing and says, "You're the baby." I was just like, "Oh shit!" They set
that
up.
Yeah, that was
up.
A shot. That was a good
awesome.
Shot.
Yeah, that was a cool setup. That was really awesome. I kept trying to think how she got the knife, though.
I think it wasn't an actual knife. I think it's made into a weapon from the closet.
Yeah, wasn't it a clothes hanger or something?
No, it was a knife.
It was bigger than a clothes hanger. I don't know. I didn't see it well enough to. I don't think it was like a handled knife.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. He wouldn't have left her in there with a knife.
Yeah, well, that's what it was. When I can actually go back to the moment, and yeah, it's a knife.
Yeah, that doesn't make any
unexplained.
Sense.
Unexplained.
No, I thought it was the salad knife.
Yeah.
Didn't she go into the closet when she still had the salad knife, like before everything went bad? And I think she might have left the knife in there. That's what I thought.
Okay.
That she had taken it in there earlier before, you know, when she first comes at him and, you know, how he's on the phone. He's like, well, mom's got a butcher knife or whatever. And she's
I do remember that. I don't remember her leaving it there, though. That's
interesting. She took the closet with her. She took it in there with her. And then I didn't see her with it after. So I kind of figured that out later. I was like, she must still have it from the last time. She must have left it in there.
Gotcha. Right.
Well, one thing that was interesting about the film is the first like hour of the film is all these videos and whatever. And there's a good point where you hear this weird dong, dong. And what it is, that was an awesome reveal. What it was is the son found all these recordings about him that his mother was going to put up and say he's a sociopath, not and all this other stuff. And he's snaps at that moment, because I didn't really worry about his personality all that much until I saw him throw the rats and against the wall and they died. And at that point I said, all right, this kid is definitely a dissocial personality. So I don't know, it's just like, how bad was he? And does it even matter? I don't know.
Oh yeah. She did leave the knife in the there. There's a point where she goes into the computer in the closet to look at something, and she has a knife in her hand. So she did leave it there.
Okay. All right. Well, that explains it. Cool.
But the son was definitely showing a lot of issues. I mean, the very one of the warning signs of such violent behavior is harm to small animals.
Right,
and the very fact that he actually starts naming those rats after the voltage he uses on them really shows a real lack of empathy towards these animals.
You think?
Well, but even that, I don't. You know, it's funny because I've mentioned I'm watching actually another in season two of The Alienist, and two of the characters are scientists and they're experimenting on rabbits to determine the lethal and. That is a thing. That is a science thing. It isn't necessarily a great thing. So I don't necessarily have a problem with him experimenting on rats, but the casually throwing the live rat back into its tank.
Yeah, right, that was the problem.
It's a casual cruelty as opposed to, hey, I'm trying to learn something here.
Mm-hmm.
That's a completely different thing.
I don't know. I mean, the very fact that he just objectifies his animals like that, and the fact that there's even the point where he's observing his mom and he has them pinned up by their tails. Dead.
Well, yeah, and that's which is something that comes up a bit later, right? It's the casual cruelty of it, as opposed to just
not to mention he cuts himself open.
Well, again, though, that we don't know if the lizard died, and then when it died, he decided to autopsy it. Or
no, I'm talking about himself.
What's that?
I'm talking about
when
himself.
He cut his chest.
Oh, right. But that doesn't necessarily mean a dissocial personality disorder. That could just be depression.
Well, and cutting the chest, by that point, we should know he's far gone, right? What he did to get to sort of get revenge on his mother goes way beyond, you know, the realm of normal mental health.
It's a prank, bro. It's a prank.
Right. It goes way beyond that. So by that point, we'd seen him abuse the rats. We know about it. We saw pieces of evidence, and none of it really looks good.
Well, and he also has an obsession, of course, with Hitler. He has an obsession with Hitler, right? We know
that.
I don't know if that's true. What he did, he had the gas mask.
Well, he was also making anti-Semitic remarks.
Didn't he name his lizards Adolf?
Yeah, he named his lizards Adolf.
Yeah, but again, that could be...
Phil, you're on the losing end of this one. Sorry.
Yeah.
I think they put... Well, but here's the thing. Wait a minute. It was very subtly done, so it wasn't obsessive, but she does make the comment that racism is a big red flag to her, right? So we do see the couple of references to Hitler and the Nazis. We do hear him watch a thing about white power on TV, and he's flipping through all this other shit, and he stops on the thing about white power. So...
He chose to stop and watch that specifically.
Right. When there was all this other stuff, there was also a show about guns. There was a show about other things he was interested in as well. And he stopped on that one. So, but what I thought was interesting was that they were not overt. Like they were all sprinkled in there. But the mother the mother was picking up on them. But, so they were made obvious to us because that's what the mother was focusing on.
That's true. I mean, the movie was trying to make us focus on what the mother was focused on. But a lot of that shit, it's stupid and it's ignorant and it's rude. But being a 15-year-old stupid kid, I could see a 15-year-old stupid kid doing something stupid like that.
Like trying to poison his friend once he finds out he's a Jew.
Oh, yeah, the
guy. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the gun stuff, the gas mask, the Nazi symbols, all that stupid stuff. That I think there's way too much being read into that as a problem.
You can't take one piece and dismiss it. And then dismiss a second piece and dismiss that and a third piece and dismiss that. You have to look at all of the pieces coming together. And there's a lot of pieces there. Again, this is not a real story. This is a fiction. They put those pieces in there for a reason. And those pieces form a very clear picture that he's got some unhealthy racial, unhealthy animus towards Jews. I don't think he ever gets into blacks, Asians, or Hispanics. Just referring to his friend or former friend or whatever you want to call him, is, you know, mentions that he's circumcised. You know, that's not a normal way you refer to somebody. And he refers to him as that after he poisons him. Right?
Formaldehyde in the mask. The mom even gets a phone call about it.
Right. I mean, the mask, I could get the mask. All right. Again, teenage boys can be interested in some pretty dark stuff. And you don't get much. Also, get very interested in stuff that's forbidden. The more forbidden something is, the cooler it kind of is. So, yeah, I get maybe the interest in Nazi paraphernalia. And let's be honest, one thing that the Nazis did really well was cool symbolism, right? They knew how to make good costumes. They certainly win the best uniforms of history kind of award, from which we've modeled all of our villain uniforms on for the last 50 years. But so you can kind of get that if he's disconnected, but all the other pieces going with it, yeah, it's not a good sign. And again, this is someone who, as the filmmakers, are trying, successfully or not, they're trying to tie a connection to this and actual events. And we do know, for example, that the Cleveland Bolton Harris had an interest in these things, going back to Columbine. So... I'm pretty sure it's intentional.
Right. It's intentional for this film. Right. But my point is that, like you've always said, Mike, about sociopaths or people growing up a certain way. It's like not everybody turns out that way, even if they did those stupid things.
as a kid, so, or grew up in a terrible house or whatever. So that's what I was trying to say. However, since this film is specifically a thriller slash horror film, all those things mean something, just specifically in this film.
Well, when you...
If it was your next-door neighbor, you just look at him and say, that's just a stupid kid.
Well, there's also some things that she kind of misjudges, like she completely associates video games, for example, with violence.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with her, because video games are violence.
But what I'm saying is, she automatically associates it as a source of creating violent behavior.
Well, that's wrong, whether it's pornography, video games, movies, music, or whatever. However, those people who say that none of those things matter are fooling themselves too. So the question is, if you're a normal, healthy individual, none of those things are going to be a problem for you. But if you're disturbed, video games, pornography, music, and movies could, and even books could possibly be an issue. You may gravitate.
It's clear that Jacob is not a normal, healthy individual.
No.
Right. So he gravitates to these things possibly because he has issues, while the us who gravitate to the violent video game don't have those issues. In other words, we gravitate. I mean, it's a question that will always be debated, and you're always going to have most people say, it's not the artist's fault. And you're right, it isn't. However, those people have to also say all those things have to play a part in the world and the culture that we live in and may not be as innocent as we all say.
Well, it's a checklist, right? And look, teenage boys are into violent things, but the more likely someone who is likely to be violent, unhealthily violent, are also really they are attracted to violent things. So you're right; it doesn't mean that something again on its own, but it's the fact that what does he do? Is he experiments on animals in his spare time, and he plays violent video games. From what we could tell from what the mother's for something like 5 to 6 hours every day. And that's like the only thing that he does. That's where you start seeing, you know, flags going up.
And he collects Nazi paraphernalia and he throws bricks into traffic.
Yeah.
And well, he throws violent once. Tantrums.
That
all
he did
the time.
Once.
He did it once. Right.
Well,
right,
once though on film.
Right. Well, for
once
a whole year
that we know of.
For a whole year, I played Fallout 4 every night for 4 hours each night.
And you're a fucking wackadoodle.
And then Far Cry 5 for 4 hours every night.
Yeah, but you do other things like podcasts about horror. Oh, wait a minute.
I
other things
animals
you do. You go out, you do your bar trivia. Well, you write. You do things that are not just.
Yeah,
you're not
consumed by it. You go on obsessive rants about cutting asparagus.
I listen to Taylor Swift.
I will.
That's a warning sign.
While somebody has brought up the footage about the brick, I did want to mention that one of the things that did stand out to me about this film that did bug me a little, and it's only a nitpick, and that is. I did not understand why we got a few snippets of obviously footage that was shot by his friend or somebody else in with the mother stuff.
Yeah, I noticed that too, Chris.
Sure,
you're
where
not,
she
you're
got
not
that.
Wrong. It was, that was that's inconsistency.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a. I didn't really like that too much. I was like, okay, that.
Much of that character, anyways, because there's a couple. So what we're talking about for our listeners is that several points that we cut to almost a quote unquote questionnaires or interviews between
him
Jacob
and a girl that he's kind of
girl. So, yeah, I
have
a friend.
A for.
That, yeah. Anyways, the point is that she asks sometimes questions that he constantly deflects, and sometimes. Responds to a question with a question. But this character only comes in like 3 shots and is never mentioned again. And for the major chunk of this film is all the recordings done by Jacob and the mother. So this weird little pop-up in this library of all this information feels kind of out of place, almost trying to give us an idea of Jacob outside of the household, but it really questions about how that got into that whole cloud of information. When the film explains how both the mother, Abby, and Jacob have been putting these videos over the course of the story.
I think Chrissy is right. It's a flaw in the film, and I also think it's what Mike mentioned earlier. What about Bob moment or whatever you call it? In other words, it was trying to make us see the character with the quote unquote friends he has, not as nice and loving to them as we thought. But it doesn't explain how they appear in with all the other videos, and I think that's a flaw. That's
well, she enters. I would argue, if I have to explain it, that she does gain access to his room. She probably has access to his computer, and so she may have copied or borrowed those files to add to her diary.
Well, and the only question I have, if that's the explanation, is was it his camera? Because it's the other people shooting him on video, so was it their camera or was it his? And if it was theirs, why does he have the video?
And the other thing, based on what we see at the very end, I think we're watching this. We're not watching this as it happened. We're watching this from the eyes of a mother who's watching the stuff that's been put online. And clearly, the mother didn't put all this stuff up yet online for other people.
Well, and I was gonna bring this up, that because the first thing you see, well, not the first thing, but at the very beginning of the movie, she's looking right into the camera and says, "If you're watching this, it's because I'm dead, and I want to try and help all the other mothers out here who have sons that they think might be a psychopath, but you can't. You have trouble doing anything about it because they're your son and you love them." So since the post credit scene, and did we all watch it, by the way?
No, I didn't.
I did.
I don't know what it is. I didn't see it.
It's pretty quick, but the post credit scene is a shot of another mother watching this video with headphones on her laptop.
Actually, I did see that the first time I watched it.
So she's watching that, and her son comes in behind her and says, "What are you watching?" And she goes, "Oh, nothing," and slams her laptop shut. And that's the post credit scene.
The cycle repeating itself.
So she's dead. She did.
Well, and that's the inference. So I'm trying to. I just want to ask you guys about that. And what do you think happened? Because at the very end of the movie, you hear the last shot, you see the mom. I mean, the whole credit scene, she's looking up at this noose that Jacob set up for her. And then right before the post-credit scenes, you hear sirens in the distance. So do you think she put some of it up online?
She had called 911. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, she had like one of those.
Well, she did call 911, but I'm assuming that since she was going to post them if she was dead, that she hung herself.
Yeah, this is what I got. Eric, you can actually, for example, the new website I'm building, you can actually write up and have all your posts up there and not have them released until a specific time or day.
Okay.
So it's possible that she had everything set up that she could stop at any time that she, you know, every day she could extend it 2, 3, 4 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's a fair point.
I also, it's a possibility that, you know, this is now the second or third, depending on your count, second or third tragedy in this family, if you count mom and son as being one or two. But it's possible that this was something put up maybe by grandma afterwards, as, you know, or if this was in mom's will, you know, as a request that be done. So that could be where some of this information comes from, which is why you might have stuff added to it that are not from.
And she did say on the 911 call, check the videos.
Right.
Yes. Yes. Right.
So maybe somebody else put it up afterwards. I'm not sure, but I thought it was kind of cool at the end that we saw another mom watching this.
Well, yeah, it kind of ties back to the lyrics of the song, where it's just like, won't be the last time, it's not the last one. It's the very fact that this almost is like a cycle that keeps repeating itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that it also kind of puts the stress on that, you know, this film really does have something to say about the nature of this sort of dangerous behavior and things like that. So it's kind of puts the period on the sentence about, look, this stuff does happen and it will happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very likely to happen again, and that we need to be aware. So, and like I said, you don't know. That's one of the things I loved. I mean, obviously, the conclusion that I came to is that there is just, you know, there is some severe psychological issues in this family. And it's not just the kid's problem. It's the mother's problem, too. And it's the grandmother's problem. Like, this is something that, you know, is a perfect storm, right? It's like you were saying earlier. One of you was saying earlier, you could have a kid that has these tendencies, but if you don't put it in the right cocktail, you know what I'm saying, with the parenting or the whatever it is, or, you know, you then perhaps those emerging tendencies, if they do emerge, they're not going to be as severe. You know,
well,
what I mean?
And I also just thought I thought the grandmother character was really pretty interesting. Because we have that story about the brother, which we haven't really gotten into detail on, but basically there was an incident when the mother was 12 that her brother basically showed up at the place where teenagers park and make out and took a shot off shotgun and killed 7 of them and then himself.
Well, they were dirty.
They were dirty. but yeah, so I thought it was really, she didn't get a whole lot of screen time, but I thought it was interesting, that grandmother character, how she was just like in complete denial about the whole thing. And she was like, oh, that happened a long time ago. We don't want to talk about that. And you were just a kid, you know, and she was completely dismissive of the possibility that some of it might be genetic. And perhaps it's because she felt some, like maybe people were trying to blame her if it was genetic. And I personally got all of that from what we saw of her, and I thought that was pretty interesting considering we didn't see a whole lot of her.
Yeah, well, also, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You read it perfectly because, again, she's the mother, and her son murdered a bunch of people at a lover's lane when he was a kid and then blew his own brains out. So obviously that tells you something about something in her history that's not good. And so when the mother, meaning Abby, so that her daughter, the grandmother's daughter, says that or brings it up, she like kind of just denies it. But as I said earlier, she then right afterwards says, you're taking your medicine, make sure you do, you know, all this other stuff. So I think she knows, but you're right. She's just trying to keep it as a denial, I guess.
Well, and I think it's really out of almost selfishness on her part. Not that she's really, I mean, of course she's concerned about her daughter. And of course she cares about her grandson, but I think to her, more importantly, she doesn't want anybody to think ill of her and think that maybe she's the cause of the genetic disposition towards mental illness.
Mm.
That was just my take.
Well, that's even if she's cognizant of a lot of that. I mean, she may be just being so in denial.
You're right. Yeah.
And she's an older wife, so she's going to be in her 60s, at least, right? Because let's see, we know that, the lead is the mom is 42,
right?
Had an older brother who is older by 4 years. So, you know, even assuming she had the child at, let's say her first child at 20, Right, she's going to be 24 years older than the mother.
She's going to be at least 62, at least, yeah.
She's going to be at least 62, probably late 60s, early 70s, when this wasn't necessarily a big thing, and they didn't necessarily talk a whole lot about mental health issues growing up. You know, and really, our generation was really the first where it became more open to talk about, and even then, it wasn't quite the same thing.
That's you're right, Mike. That is a dynamic I didn't take into consideration, is that the last generation just didn't talk about that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I was still very young back when in the early 90s and stuff like that.
I was about to say, what do you mean worse?
No, but what I'm saying
it's all relative.
A child, when I was a child, you know, when, back before, you know, I was born 91, so you know, I was still just growing up.
That's the year I graduated high school.
You're so old.
Oh crap! That's the next video thing I have to put in Facebook is for my movie for every year of your life, and for me that's year 22. So.
I almost commented on the on your last post of that to ask you if you were gonna make it before you died.
Born, Abe, I was smoking weed and getting laid and drinking every day. So there you go.
Yeah, well, I'm just what I'm saying is that Columbine and everything started taking place around that era, and you know, so I was just kind of growing up when we did the our country started finally, you know, looking at this problem. So it was a very strange, very peculiar time to just kind of see that around me, but still try to understand it, you know. So I had a very different environment, and it's even stranger now considering how these school shootings and other incidents involving young people have escalated over the years.
Yeah,
you know, our country is absolutely a mess with these in comparison to others, and
that is true.
And you know it's unbelievable because it, you know, even the song, I go back to that in the song, it even points to the other countries that somehow got it out of control, but for some reason, for us in the United States, we are still struggling to even understand the problem in the first place, much less to find a solution.
Well there's a lot of issues that go with it.
It's complicated, yeah.
Yeah, it is complicated, and there's all sorts of research out there. I do caution everybody to be careful because I know I've heard, you know, there's all sorts of statistics that are out there. And part of it is you really have to know where they get the numbers from or how do they arrive at the numbers. So, you know, like somebody, I just one that sticks in my mind was that there was a school shooting that occurred because it was at a police academy and the instructor's gun went off by accident. Nobody was injured, but it was counted in the record as a school shooting. So you get certain people on one side who want to maximize the number of school shootings.
Right,
so they say
right.
There's been like 3 school shootings every day this year, even though we haven't had school since March. But, and then you get other people who say, you know, these don't count as school shootings. Only 2 people died. What do they matter?
Jesus.
Yeah, so you go the other end. You really have to roll your sleeves up and look at the numbers, and I really haven't looked at that in terms of, and that's part of it is, and I think part of the problem even we're having, Barney getting on the soapbox now, but for the issues we're dealing right now with COVID is everything is so freaking politicized.
Yeah.
It makes it, you cannot have an honest conversation, because you cannot have an honest conversation about school shootings without the behavioral health industry getting up in arms because you're maybe making people with mental illness
NRA,
to be a pariah. You can't, have the other side who you're trying to make, you know, legal gun ownership to be a bad thing, and you want to, you know, outlaw all the illegal guns. Everything is too politicized. People just cannot step back, and we all come into this with our priors. And, you know, as someone said, if, like the thing we're going through right now, if you have not questioned any of your prior assumptions and worldviews, then you have a problem, right? Yeah. And because you really need to stop and think and ask yourself about this. If all that you saw around you just confirmed everything you already believed, you're not being honest. And that goes for everybody on any political side of any political issue. And that ties in very much with school shootings. When the people who have... When people talk about, can we just go for a couple of days without politicizing this? you know, so well, when should we wait? Wait for another child to die? It's like, no, just let the people grieve and let's emotions settle down so we can, instead of just, you know, people want to rush and grab the mic and say, it's Gunn's fault. It's not Gunn's fault. And, you know, it's mental health problem. It's not mental health problem.
And here's, here's one other point I just want to make about that, too. And I'm certainly not downplaying that we have an issue in this country, especially now in these modern times. But I would like to point out that there were school shootings before the internet. And the world was a much smaller place before the internet. There were some pretty, like, you know, school shootings in the 40s, in the 1930s. Nobody talked about this because they were local.
Right.
Because you didn't have worldwide news.
Yeah.
So
there was an incident where the guy climbed the clock tower, for example. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy, but he started shooting down with a rifle.
Yep.
That incident. That was even way before then.
Well, and if you look, a lot of this is, you know, and there I've seen some debate as to whether or not these kind of mass killings may be affecting the number of serial killers out there. The data on that is very fuzzy because they may be where before somebody might have become a serial killer. Now they're becoming a spree shooter in a school. And I have no idea if there's any truth to that or not. But if you look at, they think a lot of this is social contamination, meaning that you're getting people who are doing it because, well, they want to be famous, right? Yep. A lot of these people idolize
the
Lee Bolton Harris. Well, the kid in this movie, right? We didn't see him do any school shooter stuff, and he doesn't seem to think he's a school shooter.
No, because right? he says he'll never do that. He's like, I would never do that.
Right, but what he will do...
I believe him.
What he will do is torture his mother into committing suicide,
well,
which
that's
is...
the thing. I don't know if I believe him, because, of course, he says he's not going to do it. Do you believe him? I don't know
right.
that I do.
Well, because he also says he's not a psychopath, and I don't know that any of us believe that either.
I definitely do not believe that. Sorry, kiddo.
There's a lot. Try it again.
There's
way too many warning signs to ignore.
Thanks for playing. Yeah,
that's the thing, Abe. Is that most criminals are psychopaths, but most psychopaths aren't criminals.
A lot of CEOs are technically psychopaths.
Right, exactly. Politicians,
sociopaths.
Yeah, they're the same thing. Sociopaths.
Well, not exactly.
Pretty close. Either way, they all have just some sort of dissocial person. All right, if you want to take the four big ones, if you really want to include sociopath and psychopath is different.
The technical differences don't matter for the purpose of this conversation.
Right. But there's psychopaths, sociopaths, borderline personality disorder, and narcissist disorder. And those four are the main big ones that would go under the dissocial personality disorder or antisocial personality disorder, if you prefer. And those are the ones that are the criminals. However, most of the people with those four issues aren't criminals, if that makes sense. So most criminals are those four things, but not everybody that's those four things is a criminal. So even if this kid is one of those four things, has antisocial personality disorder, that does not necessarily mean he would murder an entire school or anything like that. However, he did tie his mother up in a closet and basically a kidnapped. So technically, he would go to jail for kidnapping for sure if she pressed charges,
which she wouldn't do.
She even mentions that during one of her videos where she's talking about how there's almost like a million reasons, quote unquote, million reasons why you wouldn't turn them in or anything like that or hate them. And it's just that struggle as a parent where even when the kid does something bad, there's even if it's something really horrible, there's that feeling as a parent that you still love them, even though you could also hate them.
Mm-hmm. And that's a common theme in real life stories and movies about things like this. We've already referenced this movie several times during this conversation. We need to talk about Kevin. Same thing. The mother still loves her son, but she hates him. so it's, I guess a mother's love is permanent, but it doesn't mean there can't be other emotions as well.
Right.
So I was just looking at the IMDb page for, I don't know how to pronounce this name. It's spelled T-U-C-I-A. Is that Tucia?
Yeah, that's the director.
Yeah, director and screenwriter. And this looks like the first feature she's done. Most of her other credits are for television. And I would like to see her do more stuff because I enjoyed this.
It was really well written for the most part. One part of me actually first thought when we were building up to certain reveals and stuff like that, that it wasn't Jacob who did those drawings, but herself that did those drawings.
Interesting.
You know, like she's projecting her own problems onto her son.
Well, the Ed Asner character, which, by the way, it was delightful to see Ed Asner. I was like, oh, that's so nice. A friendly face from the 70s. You know, you know, that I remember when I was a little kid. He does make a reference. He says to her, do you remember what kinds of things you were drawing at that age or whatever? She does the same thing her mother does. Yeah, she says, oh, well, we don't really – I was kind of hoping we would just be talking about Jacob. Like, right, I don't want to talk about that.
Right. And then she deflects hangs up on him. Yep. Then she hangs up on him too.
Then she hangs up on him the same way that Jacob hangs up on his grandmother. Right. And she yells at him for that. So there's also an implication here that – some of Jacob's behaviors are learned. There is that suggestion too, that some of his behaviors are learned from watching, like the way his mother behaves.
Was there a specific piece of dialogue that you got that from, or was it a general impression?
No, it was the way that he slammed. You know, he hung up on the video chat and she yelled at him for it, right?
Uh-huh.
And then she, later on, we see her, she does the same thing. She does the same thing to Ed Asner. Well, and then there's a couple of other moments where it's very clear that he is copying her behavior, or he just thinks it's acceptable because that's what he's learned from watching her.
Well, I think it also comes back to the mother's own parent, the grandmother, where it goes back to, I think, what Mike or Phil said about how they're very fixated on appearances. Because Abby puts on a lot of makeup and stuff like that, beauty products and stuff she has all the time.
Yes.
And so she's pretty much learned that behavior from her own mother of trying to keep up of this quote-unquote appearances of this beauty and stuff like that. So she's in denying it, or she's completely oblivious to the very fact that she's almost her own mother.
Well, nobody wants to admit that, whether you're a wackadoodle or not. Oh, darn it! Sorry, I just totally had a brain fart. I forgot what I was going to say.
You were saying wackadoodle.
Wackadoodle. I always have fun saying that word.
Well, one of the things let's also remember is that we find out at the end of the film, the son is tampering with his mother's medication.
Yes.
Which may have a lot to do with her behavior becoming more unhinged at this point, you know, even as we pick the film up. Because we see, and I was wondering about that, like she's got some eczema on her hands, right? We see rashes or skin peeling blemishes on her hands.
That's right.
And he mentions while she's locked in the closet after she's been off her medication now for a bit, that it seems to have cleared up. And she's wondering, like, because she hasn't been on her medication and she realized she's been tampering with her medication. And I'm curious if, like, the writer actually knows what he did. Just didn't bother informing the audience, you know, because I'd be curious to do a little, which I haven't had a chance to do a little bit of sleuthing to see if we can figure out what was added to it that could have maybe made her even more unhinged, or was it just the denial of medicine, or did he add something to it? So, I'm really curious how that that aspect of the story played out. But again, that's kind of that. I like that they didn't take the time to spell out everything.
Mm.
You know, aha, mom, I put hydroxychloroquine in your again.
Dun, dun, dun.
Whatever it is. So yeah, this gets to be a very tangled knot, and I think it's fair to both behavioral health individuals. But I do think it's also fair to say that we do have a tendency to lump all crazy people in together. And you know, violently crazy are not all going to go shoot up schools. So this kid may not necessarily, it's not like it's a requirement, it's a checkbox. Okay, I'm violently crazy now, and now I have to go shoot up a school. You know, you can be violently insane in lots of different ways.
I think that's
the main moral of this story, is that if you're crazy, you don't have to shoot up a school. You can just torture your family instead.
That's the moral of the story.
Yeah. You don't, I mean, you know, why go through all that trouble and, you know, kill 20 people when you can just really destroy one and have a better time doing it?
Oh, and isn't it really all come back to the mom anyway? Right? I mean, isn't it all just about the mom? That's what it's always about with the psychologist. So just take it out on your mom. That's the whole.
Well, and I do have an interesting question too. That store that she shopped in and that they went to, what kind of store was that? Because she's like, oh, we went to this store to find him shorts and something else. And of course, he's nowhere to be found. It didn't look like, I don't know, it looked like some kind of weird hardware store where she went to buy the camera and everything.
Right.
It didn't look like a place that sold shorts. This is a dumb thing, but I was really curious.
Yeah, well, because it had video games, it had hardware, it had clothing. It was almost like a mock-up Walmart or some shit like that, or general store of some kind. Because there was a variety of kinds of weird shit in there.
Where was the set? Do we remember?
Does it say?
Something Ohio?
Yeah, I think it was Ohio. So I don't know. I don't live in Ohio. Eric, you're in the Midwesty area. And Ohio's stuck between us. I have no idea if there's any shops.
I've driven through Ohio several times, never really stopped and visited.
Yeah, never stopped to look, huh?
No, it was just an odd kind of a store to me. So I was just like, and I noticed it. Like every time she was in there, it just looked so fascinating to me. I'm like, what kind of store is that? It looks sort of like a hardware store, but not really. And then she, oh, and also thank you for mentioning the eczema, because I did not notice that. So one of the notes that I had made was, why is she wearing gloves? I missed that detail, so now I understand why.
Yeah, me and my wife were confused about that, because my wife wears the gloves and I never did.
I was like, oh my god, is she OCD maybe? I wasn't sure.
And then she got that package, and it was the medicine. Her son said, I think your medicine's here. And she takes off her gloves, and she has like red marks, and then she talks about, it's just my eczema or whatever the
okay, thing I must have missed that for whatever reason. I don't know why.
Just found there's one piece of trivia on this on IMDb, and it's kind of interesting, which is that in that video that we were referencing at the beginning of the movie where you can hear the father's voice, that voice is Anthony Edwards, who is the real life father of Bailey Edwards that played Jacob.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow, cool. I thought the IMDb trivia would be explaining who exactly screwed Ed Asner to get him into the movie.
Yeah, that was super cool. That was just so cool. I love nowadays you just kind of get that treat every once in a while.
But
you're like,
always,
you know, some random dude will show up from like 100 years ago and you're like, oh my god, that's so cool. Like,
well, I do wonder why. Was it like, was he like, you know, the, well, we have this much money, we could either spread it out evenly or put 90% of it getting an actor with a name that we can put on the front of the DVD box to get people to pick it up.
Like Dark Pleasance with Halloween.
You know, so that we can get, because we know Grandma will pick it up if she says Ed Asner is in it. or was this made by like a family friend? Or, you know, so I'm really curious how he ended up in there. And that's one of the things that's sort of like Ted Danson in Saving Private Ryan. You know, he has a cameo in it.
Yeah, the cameo, yeah.
And it just was so, like, weird because he just walks into it as a cameo and he disappears. It's like, why was he in this movie? And it's right. And it's the point where, to me, a cameo becomes almost distracting. I think it has worked here, but I just, why? Why was he in it? That's just a thing that's kind of bugged me until I find out. How did Ed Asner end up in the movie?
You know, who knows? It could have been a family friend, or maybe she was related to him and said, hey, you want to help me out with my little film movie, Uncle Ed, or whatever, you know?
Right, and we know, like, Malcolm McDowell will, like, do apparently anything for a buck nowadays. Because he's been in a lot of
cheap shows. Lance Hendrickson's another one.
Well, Lance Hendrickson was, you know, he was always working for a buck. He was never a name. What's that?
He's a whore.
Yeah, kind of. Well, no, look, we understand there's genre names like Lance Hendrickson, you know, that, you know, people who are pay attention to genre cinema, they know who it is. But, you know, using my, my rule of thumb, you know, my mother wouldn't know. The same as, you know. Like, well, Malcolm McDowell, if you mention, you know, he was kind of a name, certainly for doing Alex and Clockwork Orange, among other things. But yeah, it's just weird that Ed Asner is a name. He is a big name. Why was he here? And certainly he didn't need the money, I don't think. You know, he's not like, you know, Nick Cage, massive debt to the IRS. That I get.
Right.
He'll make Mom and Dad or you know, or Mandy or what have you, color out of space because he needs the money.
So is there anything else we want to hit here, or are we done with this?
Yeah. Anything else? Any scenes anybody want to bring up that we forgot? Anything or comments or anything?
Well, here's the thing. I do also question where the mom is on this spectrum. Like, one of the things the son has the mother do is confess to the camera that she told her brother.
Yeah, I was wondering about that too. And I also was wondering how, when she says, I never told him about Jerry, so did the grandmother tell? Because it seemed like he knew.
I thought he said something about looking it up on the internet.
Yeah, that would be my.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah,
he said the internet doesn't keep secrets.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah. Okay, yep.
Yeah, you type in Jerry Mom's Maiden Name, and I am sure that's going to be like the first thing you hit after the links to the porn sites. So there's that, and then, but it's the did she really tell him to do it or not? That I don't know. She certainly has mental health issues, but how much of that stems back to the trauma she had to deal with as a child from what her brother did.
Mm-hmm.
And then even what she did at the end and killing her son and killing herself, you know, why was that? Now, she had been locked in a closet long enough that she had been off her meds and for eczema to go away. So it wasn't a thing of she's been in there for a day. You know, she was probably in there for a while. She was dying. She was thirsty,
mm-hmm.
probably severely dehydrated, probably severely affected by hunger, paranoid, you know. So I don't know that, like, did she have psychopathic tendencies too, or is it just a different type of mental issue that she was dealing with? It's like a psychological issue. And I don't think that's really it.
Or... Yeah. Was she convinced that the only way for her to survive was to kill her son?
Yeah.
And then it might have been too, but I think she's not in her right frame of mind.
Well,
so
definitely.
I think this, the point of this seems to be on the part of the filmmaker is, aha, it was the mom all along. She really was crazy. And that's what I said, when I think they tipped their hand a little too early, where they have the son, I think, say something, I'm not the crazy one, you're the crazy one. And they do everything they can to kind of throw shade at the mom throughout and offer that question as to the sanity of the son. And I think they reveal that hand just a little too early. So at least for me, I'm kind of expecting it to turn out to be, you need that twist ending, because otherwise it's not really a story. If you don't have something happen that's along the way that's unexpected.
I would love to ask the writer-director questions about this. Phil, get an interview.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're the type that would possibly jump on, too.
That would be cool.
They might also say, and it's perfectly annoying but respectable to say, that's for the viewer to decide.
That's true.
Yeah. But I'm saying is that if you take the mom out of this, which is kind of hard to do because she's so...
There's not much of a movie.
I would say, but if that was someone else, let's say that was the Jewish friend who had been locked in the closet and tortured. Okay. And they came out and stabbed the son. Would anyone think, well, it must have been a sociopath?
Right. No, I see your point right there.
So we're not exactly getting a fair shake either way. Again, circumstances are a big part of it.
Well, I think that's one of the cool. That's kind of the cool thing about this movie, is that there's so much here. And really, you can take what's presented to you in any number of ways and not necessarily be wrong or right.
I think the rats made him do it.
Those poor rats.
I think it was the violent video games.
The poor rats.
You did have a couple of fun allusions in here, too. There was, of course, the allusion to Blair Witch when she's sitting in the closet and she's going, I'm so sorry, you know, with the tears or whatever. There's kind of an interesting allusion to the classic book and film, you know, Willard, where the loner, you know, the crazy guy basically is obsessed with rats. So there were a couple of really fun little very subtle allusions to other horror movies in here. I'd like to say that they probably were intentional. They may not have been, but I picked up on them. So.
Right.
So anyway, I just wanted to mention those too. I think there were a couple of others, but I didn't write them down like a dummy, so I don't remember what they are, but yeah.
Right.
I will say, now that we've talked about it and sang the film's praises, and I may be talking out my ass here, I am a little uncomfortable with them taking a movie like this and kind of trying to use it as a platform.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because this isn't like we need to talk about Kevin, which I thought was a very somber and serious film addressing the issues of school violence and the impact it has on the family and maybe how it comes about. This feels a lot more exploitation-y as a movie. This is not something like you could say, is this another story about a crazy kid who locks his mother in a closet and mom comes out and kills him and commits suicide?
It's not a normal story. Seems like something that could have been ripped from the headlines directly out of real life, whereas this movie doesn't really.
Well, my take on that, and I do agree with you, Mike, but I think this film, for me, it was less talking about the child that is a little out there or, you know, that is crazy or psychopathic and may or may not do violent things. I really think this movie was more of a comment on the insecurities of being a parent. That is, to me, that was my big takeaway from it, that it was more about, you know, the insecurities of being a person who knows that there's psychological issues in her family, who is hyper aware that her child could be like her brother. And even the message at the end, we're anti-school. They gave you a hotline number for, I believe it was violence, abuse, and trauma. So I don't think it was necessarily trying to talk about the school shooting issue. I think it was really trying to talk more about the insecurities of parenting and things like that.
Well,
I think
not necessarily school shootings, but mental health and violence and even the parenting. It's like at least four of us are old enough to remember the very special episode.
Yeah.
Right? This is a very special episode of Different Strokes. You're like, oh, fuck, I'm not going to laugh at all tonight, am I?
yep.
And it turns out, Arnold's best friend gets molested by the guy who owns the candy store. Yeah. Okay. And they throw it in there. It's not like they do that. They would do that in an episode of like I Love Lucy, where Lucy's does something stupid and she's afraid Ricky's going to come home and kill her, and it's all played up for laughs. And then they end. If you want to learn more about domestic violence, please file this stuff. It would just feel completely out of place. And that's sort of where I feel like for this is that they didn't treat it in a way that was serious. I'm not saying that the issues it raises aren't serious, but it was done in a way that was perversely entertaining and fantastical and not something that would normally happen as we see. You know, it doesn't feel ripped from
it was a midnight movie, a grindhouse film.
Right, and
it's
just
supposed to be a drama.
I get what you're saying, Mike.
We need to talk about Kevin.
It was a little weird to have that at the end of there.
I would agree.
Right, you wouldn't do Homo with a shotgun and then have a homeless hotline at the end.
Yeah, but at the same time, in the world we live in today, I don't think it's inappropriate to put up a warning of that kind of thing or a support line of that kind of thing anywhere, anytime, anyplace.
I don't have a problem with it. It just feels weird. Is basically I'm
well,
just,
and can I make one other comment, Mike? Because I also I do agree with you that it feels a little weird and out of place. But also, I think what we need to remember too is that it's okay. So Phil, Eric, Mike, and I are all the same age. Abe is younger, but there's a new generation that's like a little younger than Abe. They might need this level in order to access this. We're older. So like you said, we remember the special episodes. I don't even think they do special episodes anymore for stuff like that, for big issues. I really don't. I think they just kind of like, because these kids today are so all over the internet and Snapchat. And I mean, they are exposed to everything.
There's a lot of sources compared to what it was in the past. I mean, there's no shortage of different kind of news articles, journalistic stuff, videos, also covered news or topics and stuff like that. And there's a lot of, I mean, and some things just cover in different ways, sometimes inaccurately or twisting spins. So, yeah, you're right. There's almost no filter as to what young people this generation are. And to find
it. I'm certainly not criticizing the younger generation. That's not what the younger generation I'm doing. What I'm saying is I think the world that they live in is very different. And they might actually need something a little bit more sensational and grabby and a little more exploitative to get them to pay attention. That's all I'm saying. Because they do, you know, oh my God, like things like Snapchat honestly just blow my fucking mind. Like, how the hell do you talk on something like that and then it just fucking disappears in 5 minutes? That would make me crazy. Like, just pick up a phone. But they're into that, you know, and that's the kind of thing they like. So maybe this is a style that is necessary for those generations in order to grab it better. Because we are from a different time. Do you know what I mean? So I don't know.
Yeah.
I just figured I'd throw that out there just for shits and giggles. It's just a thought. You know, and I do certainly agree with you. It felt weird to me, but it might not feel weird to a freaking 18-year-old. You know, I don't know. That might be typical of how they, you know, who knows? I don't know. Like I said, Snapchat blows my mind. I don't understand that, but whatever. You know, it's like it's all good. It's their thing. But yeah, so anyway.
All right, so we're actually here with the director and writer, and probably many other things that you are doing on the film as well. Why don't you introduce yourself and explain who you are?
You got it. I like how you avoided trying to pronounce my name, because I know it's a tricky tricky name to pronounce. But my name is Tusia Lyman. And yeah, I'm the writer and director of Mom, Mothers of Monsters.
Right. And actually, we want to thank Wendy Colton, who is your PR person, who was able to set up this interview for us. And she specifically spelled out how, in pronunciation, how to say your name. She said (2-C-A-H). And then she said the C is the high sound in your name.
Yeah,
Tushia.
We've done a few podcasts, and even Siri pronounces my name as Tusha, and Alexa pronounces my name as Tusha, but it's actually Tusia. So she's told me multiple times, remind everyone when you do these podcasts to how to pronounce your name. And I say, okay, and I always forget. So now she reminds people for me.
Well done. And I actually instant messaged Eric and said it's too seer, and I basically cut and paste what she wrote in the email. So
And I was messing with him, typing all sorts of incorrect things back.
Right, to be a wise guy.
Just to make him really nervous.
For Halloween last year, because Siri calls me Tusha, I dressed up as Fuchsia Tusha. So I had a fuchsia a wig, and fuchsia lipstick, and fuchsia nails. Nobody got it, but I got it.
Hey,
that's all that matters.
You're amused. That's what matters.
Exactly. Thank you.
Exactly. Anyway, so we're glad that you're here, so we could actually talk about your film. Obviously, we did a recording of the film itself. We don't discuss it and all that, but it's always cool to have one of the creators or performers join us to maybe get some insight that, you know. And so we're here to do that, and I guess we can start some questions. Why don't you start, Eric?
Okay. I'm just going to throw this out here at the beginning, which is that I don't know how Phil is going to edit this in along with the discussion we had about it, but we're probably going to cover some spoiler territory while talking to Tusia. So,
spoiler alert.
You should listen to this part after you've seen the movie. The movie's available on Amazon Prime. So go check it out and come back and listen to this afterwards. So that being said,
hey Eric, it's also free on Tubi. Of course, Tubi has the commercials if you can grin and bear it, but on Tubi as well.
Tubi, okay, great, good to know. IMDb has been taken over by Amazon, so that's all they show on here.
Got it.
So I guess my first question for you, one of the things I noticed about this movie is it has a lot of true to life dynamic as far as teenage boy. So I'm wondering if you have one in your life.
So the question is, do I have a teenage boy in my life? So
yes.
I will tell you, Eric, much like Philip, I'm from back east. I'm from Massachusetts, and I'm from a really big family, and I have 7 brothers.
Ah.
So I have had, over the course of my lifetime, many a teenage boy in my life. And then, of course, high school and college. But I also have, believe it or not, 8 sisters. And all of them have kids. And most of those, you know, my extended family, my nephews, nieces and nephews are boys. So I don't have a teenage boy myself. Like, I'm not a mom. But I have a lot of teenage boys who I love, who are in my life. And of course, you know, growing up with 7 brothers, I think I know a lot about teenage boys.
Well, I would agree, because while I was watching the movie, it's like, I mean, I was a teenage boy, and I recognize some things going on here that used to be me. I was like, whoa, I don't think I'm a psychopath. But yeah, a lot of it is right there. Because honestly, it's hard to tell the difference between an actual psychopath and just a teenage boy, because they cover a lot of the same territory.
Yeah, you know what? You're 100% right about that. And what's interesting is that, listen, every single teenage boy that's ever been born goes through a phase, you know, in their early to mid teens, where, you know, their bodies are being flooded by hormones, and they're physically changing. They're also mentally changing. And there's all of that, you know, teenage angst that happens. So I think that part of this movie is, you know, embracing that cycle of a young teenage boy, what he goes through. I'm pretty well informed about, you know, I'm not a teenage boy. I've never been a teenage boy, but I'm pretty well informed as far as what they go through. You know, I have a lot of sisters who have had boys, and I've seen what they go through in their early to mid teens. And I always find it fascinating, the changes, the awkwardness, the, you know, the, whether you're confident and whether you're aware of your of your body. You're always aware of your body, and you know, you've got pimples and hormones and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's a natural phase, I think, in the life cycle that that I am familiar with, even though I don't have a kid, you know.
Well, and I think you nailed the dynamic as far as your screenwriting and what you got out of your young actor there. So I say well done. So I will give Phil the opportunity to ask you the next question.
Yeah, just to add on to what you two folks have said. Yeah, I was the one that defended Jacob most during our discussion of the film, because until what he did to his pets, up until then, I just thought he was just acting like a stupid teenager, even when he dropped the brick over the overpass. But generally, everything else is like, I don't know, he just seems like a stupid kid. But and then you slowly progress and we see. But my question was, I'm a big fan of the book We Need to Talk About Kevin that was written by Lionel Shriver. And I read that book twice. And I've seen the film, of course, and we actually did an episode on the film. And I've always pushed that film and book because I just really interesting character studies of a number of the two main characters. And I was curious because we compared your film a little bit to that source material. For the book, Eric and the other co-hosts were more talked about the novel. I mean the movie, because they actually seen the movie and hadn't read the book. And I was stating how this was kind of a found footage version of that type of story. And I was curious if that book had any influence on your topic and to write and direct a film like this.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think that We Need to Talk About Kevin, which, of course, is a scripted drama, is one of the most powerful films I've seen. And of course it was also directed by a woman. It was directed by
Nick. It was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And she did just a tremendous job with that film. I will say that as an artist, sometimes it's hard to identify what exactly has influenced you. But once you start creating a film, writing the screenplay and all of that, I think intrinsically you kind of go back to what has influenced you. And We Need to Talk About Kevin absolutely did. I've seen that film probably 4 or 5 times because it's such a powerful film and they did such a good job of not glorifying the violence, the actual act. Now they did go a step further than I went. Of course, you know, that film was made, you know, what was it, like 2000, I want to say 11?
Yeah, yeah, it was around then, because it was near when we first started the podcast, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's when we started around then.
So certainly it was after Columbine, the Columbine shooting, because that was in 1999. But since then, I think we've learned a lot more as a society about copycats and how important it is not to necessarily sensationalize the actual act of shooting up a school. Of course, in We Talk About Kevin, it was with a bow and arrow. But all of the films I've seen, I also saw Zero Day, The Dirties, which are found footage films. But, The Dirties especially is the same.
That's a good one.
Have you seen The Dirties?
Yeah, that's a Canadian film. It was on Netflix, and I saw it. It was pretty damn good.
Why does that film get so much pushback as far as, oh, it wasn't real, it wasn't this? I think that film was extraordinary. But it is about, from the kid's point of view of a school shooting. And I can't say it's, listen, it's a traumatizing movie because it's a traumatizing event. But yes, absolutely, We Need to Talk About Kevin was certainly, charged in my consciousness when I was writing this film because it is one of my top 10 favorite films. I will say that watching it after I made the film, I realized more similarities than I had actually been aware of while I was writing the screenplay for it. And I thought, and I give that film credit for that. It's the only film that's been made to my knowledge, besides Mothers of Monsters, that is from the mother's point of view. Of course, in We Need to Talk About Kevin, she is so unsure. She has so much trepidation about, is she right? Is he a psychopath, or am I, am I struggling with some kind of insecurity or disability? And I think in Mom, the mom, Abby, the mom of Jacob, is not aware at all of her own issues. She's much more aware of the fact that Jacob, her kid, is a problem. She's scared he's going to do it. And of course, we find out during the film that she has a pretty complex backstory where she has some, you know, she has a brother who was a violent, you know, a violent youth. So I do think that film influenced me quite a bit. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. No, it most certainly does. Yeah. If you definitely like the movie, definitely read the book. The book actually talks about Columbine because he has a kind of scrapbook of all the shootings, and there's some switches too, like it's actually a crossbow he uses in the book and not a bow and arrow, so he's more able to take out the people and stuff. So spoiler alert for people who don't know anything about that movie.
I did read the book, and it's one of those things where how does the book differ from the movie. I thought the movie did a really great job translating that book. Of course, the book is always much more detailed. It's going to have a lot more of that information and backstory. But it was a tremendous work of art.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, what you said here will give me some further questions to ask you. But before I do that, let's go back to York.
I guess my next question was going to be just about how the film is laid out because it's found footage, as you mentioned. And I was wondering how strictly you had it laid out as far as the order of the story and what you were going to show. Or if you just like shot a whole ton of footage and did a lot of the writing and the editing process or how you went about that. How much of it was sequentially laid out ahead of time?
You know, it's interesting because I'm a huge found footage fan, I guess. Not that, you know, listen, when I first watched, you know, the Blair Witch Project, I was like, I don't understand, because I work in television and film, but, you know, it's very shaky cam for Blair Witch. And once I knew that it wasn't, these weren't real tapes of people who had disappeared in the woods after trying to, you know, figure out this legend of a witch. I did have a hard time with, okay, this guy is a cameraman. This character in the movie is actually a cameraman in real life, and that's what that's why they brought him on the trip into the woods. And yet, everything he does is so shaky, and I thought it was overdone. I thought it was like we're trying to be so real that you know we're trying to be real. But I do think that film, you know, pioneered the subgenre of found footage. And I always loved found footage. And I've watched, I can't say I've watched every found footage film, but I've certainly watched a lot. And I've watched the early ones, you know, that predate the Blair Witch Project, which are ones like the Cannibal Holocaust. You know, I don't know if you guys have seen that, but I do love the format of found footage. And you know, I've worked in television for 17, 18 years, and I work a lot in documentary television, unscripted television. So I understand the elements of story. So I will say that everything in that film was scripted to the T. I think that what was challenging was early on when we were doing all of the auditions was finding the caliber of actor who could make it feel like a found footage film. And I think we did find those people, you know, Melinda Page Hamilton, who plays Abby, the mom, and Bailey Edwards, who plays the kid, the son. They absolutely embodied the essence of that character. And yes, did we ad lib? Absolutely. You would be a very narrow-minded director if you didn't allow your actors to ad lib and to expand on the material, right? To make the material bigger than you would have ever imagined it as the writer or director. I will say that there are a few things that we did not have in the original screenplay, and one of them was the documentary footage of Jacob as a kid. That was never in the original screenplay. But what happened is during the, you know, when we were doing the rough cut of the film, and we were doing a lot of screenings along the way with friends and colleagues to figure out, okay, what was resonating with people, what wasn't. And we got a lot, it'd be questionnaires that we would pass out, and we got a lot of feedback about, but what was he like as a kid before he was, you know, before the movie starts, when he was before 17 or 16, when the movie starts. And we thought, yeah, that's a, you know, that was never in the screenplay, but what could it have been like? And, you know, I'm very close to, you know, I'm pretty informed when it comes to the profiles, or actually the lack thereof, of profiles of these school shooters. And so I went to Bailey, who's the actor who plays Jacob, and I said, is there any chance that you have footage of yourself as a kid that we could play with and manipulate and maybe help the audience understand what you may have been like as a kid, and also to establish that Abby, the mom, who you realize through the course of the film is pretty neurotic, that she may have been filming you from a young age. And I can't say it was my idea. It was actually it was several people who had seen the film, who were in the business, who had encouraged that idea. And, you know, sure enough, I got, you know, we got a box of tapes of the actual Bailey Edwards, the actual actor as a kid, real home video.
So that was actually him. I was wondering about that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So we went through that footage and we thought, it was a lot of footage, you guys. And we just looked at it, and I went through it with Bailey, with the actor. I was lucky enough to have Bailey live down the street from me, which we didn't know when we cast him. And so he would come over and we'd go through all of this footage and think, how could we manipulate this to make it look like you were a you know, psycho as a kid? and we were able to, you know, and working with Melinda, we were able to take that footage and use VO over it so that, of course, you know, what you know, Bailey's real life mom may have been saying was very different from what our mom in the movie was saying. We were able to use those moments where he's staring off into the distance. You know, of course, he's staring off talking about a sandwich, but we're making it about, did you mean to kill that animal? You know what I mean? So we worked, that was not in the original screenplay. We worked together, mostly addressing viewers' notes, to seed that, you know, that disability, that disorder early in his life, because that is typically how it does happen.
The warning gotcha. Signs.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So it looks like Abe showed up.
Yes, my internet finally caught up. Yay.
Yeah, and Abe is from Massachusetts. He's from Lowell, Massachusetts. So Tessier is actually originally from Massachusetts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm a Boston girl.
Oh, wow.
In my early years.
Holy crap.
The first half of my life. I mean.
Small world. So, Abe, you got a question, my friend.
Yes. So now hearing that the added footage and stuff like that, was there a draft of the film where these things were not included?
Well, what wasn't included?
The footage of childhood and everything like that. Was there?
Yeah, early on, that was never part of the original screenplay, but it became from notes from our early viewers, the early, you know, rough cuts, where we realized that they really wanted to see, and I have to say, not only Jacob as a child, but they wanted to see Jacob with his friends, and that wasn't in the original screenplay.
Uh-huh.
Meaning his friend Lily that he does Truth or Dare with, or he's, you know, he's snapping rubber bands and he pushes her into the street and cars honk, and she's like, dude, this isn't okay. None of that was in the original screenplay, and that just came, that was inspired by Mark Polish, who is a very, very good director, who's a colleague of ours, of Bailey's, and you know, viewer feedback, which was like, we want to see more of who he was, who he was over the years, and not just starting from the time.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
So it was more of like almost like isolation in terms of where the setting was all in the house originally.
Well, it was in the house, and it was also in the high school, and it was in his, you know, his science teacher's class. It was him walking down the street. So a lot of little scenes happened outside the house, but the majority of what happens in the film is inside the house. That is very, very purposeful. And it's because, you know, I've done a lot of research about school shooters, and I'll tell you the full story, you know, in a minute here. But what I had learned through several years of research was that a lot of the dysfunction that happens, a lot of these school shooters come from, that there's patterns in their past. And one of the patterns is single home parenting. Another pattern is, sure, there's you know, violent video games and, you know, access to military grade weapons, but there's also a clear dysfunction of communication that happens between parents and their kids. And to me, after doing a lot of research, I realized it's much more about that. It's much more a problem of society, which sadly makes it even more complex than it is a political agenda about mental health or gun control or any of the things that, that everyone, you know, makes it about. It's not a political issue, right? It's a human issue. It's a family issue. And most of family interactions happen inside the house. So I did want to keep it anchored at home because that was authentic to where the issue originates, you know?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, my question was a follow-up to some of that, which is, you know, one of the childhood scenes was him throwing mud at a little girl. And it, we discussed that a lot. And I said, who hasn't done that? I mean, you know, you take a big chunk of mud and you're about to throw it and you say, don't do it, don't do it. And you know, the kid does it anyway. And I'm guilty of that when I was 5 years old. So certain things like that, you could look either way. But as we know that it's taking place in the quote unquote present, our lead Abby, the mother, she has seen Jacob in more, you know, in a different way than the rest of us. We're just viewing what you show us, but she's lived it for, you know, she's around 40 or 50, I think you said in the movie. But she's, you know, his 14 to 16 years, however old he is. And so my question was, is though we knew this was going to be a thriller slash horror film, so we knew that most likely if there wasn't going to be a twist, he was going to be at least partly to blame as a sociopath. And I was curious, what scenes did you put in, including the ones you added on after the fact, to make us point to or make the audience look at him as maybe he is the actual villain? And then, you know, there is a twist because we do find out about Abby later. But throughout, you're still questioning, is he just being a stupid kid or is he a sociopath? And I think my point where I decided he was a sociopath was when he tossed his pet. Because, you know, the first one of the three sociopath things is killing animals. So I don't know if that was a well-asked question, but I think you know what I'm trying to ask you.
I mean, listen, there are certain patterns when you look at school shooters, when you look at psychopaths, or, you know, before you're 18, you cannot be legally diagnosed as a psychopath. It's more sociopathic tendencies, which is a line in the film. So we did look at the patterns that happen in these kids, in these teens. And one of them, of course, is animal cruelty. It's a blatant disregard for life, not just human life, but animal life. Like no connection to life, death, like they have no emotional connection or accountability for that. So at one point, you know, we talked about putting that into the film, and I thought, oh, but it's so stereotypical. Of course, I know a lot more about this than most of our viewers might. And so I thought, you know, I think it's something that is important to talk about. And it is an important sign. And, you know, something that's very interesting to me is that, you know, at the end of the film, we have a toll-free 800 number. It's a mental health number. And when that film, when the film came out, it was more like a month after the film came out, that number was inundated with calls from moms who were scared of their kids, moms who thought their kids were capable of violence to others, and some moms who, actually quite a bit of moms, who thought that their kids were capable of murder. There was a lot of debate with me and the investors and producers about whether we should put a toll-free number at the end of the film. And we ended up deciding that it could be useful. We might as well put it there. that number has been inundated. You know, we partnered up with a number of nonprofit mental health organizations before we ever made the film because I knew so much about school shootings from the Sandy Hook Elementary school shooting in Connecticut in 2012. My sister lives in Connecticut, and her daughter, my niece, almost went to that school. And of course, in 2012, a former student went into Sandy Hook Elementary and basically massacred 26 people. 20 of them were kids, were first and second graders, mostly first graders. My sister's daughter, my niece, would have been in that class had she gone to that school, and she almost went to that school. So when the news came out in 2012 that this massacre had happened at Sandy Hook Elementary, I couldn't get hold of my sister because the lines were all dead because it was a nationwide emergency, right? And I remember that palpable fear of, oh my God, could my niece have been in that classroom? Could she have been shot? Could she be dead? And that is what triggered. Now, this is back in 2012, well before I ever had the idea of making this film. But that fear triggered something in me that made it very, very real of like, wait, how could this happen? How can a kid, you know, even in the Sandy Hook shooting, and I won't say his name. I'm not a proponent of sharing the shooter's names because, of course, that can inspire copycats. But, you know, this kid who was a former student of Sandy Hook Elementary, how could he have so much hatred, you know, harbor so much hatred and disregard for human life that in his mind as a young adult, he thought that it was okay and it could solve his problems to go into a school with multiple weapons and mow down, massacre 26 people. So I became very invested early on, and like I said, way before I had the concept of this film, of like, how does this happen? There must be an answer, right? Well, of course, the more you study these profiles, the more you learn there is no answer, meaning it's not as simple as mental health or gun control or video games. It's not as simple as that. It has much more to do with a fundamental breakdown of communication between a mom and a son, between the family unit. And then, of course, you have society, and then you have, you know, the country. This is a uniquely American problem, right? Asia has way more video games, violent video games, than we do, right? And they have a fraction of mass shootings and school shootings. So I was very invested in figuring out, and I was very sure at the time I could figure out how this happened and how to solve it, and I couldn't, because it's much more complex than any of us know. But I do think it has a lot to do with the breakdown of communication in our families. And I think it has a lot to do with, sure, yes, kids are playing a lot more video games than they ever used to, but they're not learning real life problem solving skills. They're not learning how to deal with real life issues because they're learning how to deal with, you know, blowing up the enemy and, you know, how to launch a grenade and how to build a wall and then launch a grenade off the wall. So, yes, is it violent? Yes. Scientifically, they have not been able to connect the violence of video games with, you know, the culture of youth violence that's happening in this country. They haven't been able to connect it because I don't think it's as simple as that. I think it is much more to do with, as a society, our inability to communicate, to communicate, our inability to have, you know, problem solving skills to be able to deal with real life issues. That people are, you know, teens especially, are just, you know, separated from. They're on Instagram, Snapchat, and TikTok, and they don't know how to communicate necessarily in a real world way.
I also think there's also when, because I play some horror games and stuff like that, and I think there's also the lack of inability of some of those people to separate the media from reality and stuff like that. The way that certain things are depicted and stuff like that, and some way, and also the way maturity to approach that is just a creation of a story or stuff like that.
Listen, I mean, there have been studies about do violent video games create more aggression in teenagers? Yes, of course the answer is yes. But that is very different from a teenager going into a school with an AR-15 and mowing down all of his classmates. That's a big...
Absolutely, yeah.
And if you look at all of the other countries and continents, this is a uniquely American problem. And so you cannot pinpoint it to, oh, it's violence in video games or violence in TV or access to military-grade weapons. What I think you can pinpoint it to is a breakdown of communication, and that's what this film is about. It's about one mother, right, and one son who absolutely have not been able to communicate, have failed to communicate. And, of course, it builds upon itself, and you realize, yes, there's baggage. There's always baggage. All of us have baggage, right? But I do think there are solutions that are not about video games or over-medication or single-home parenting or, you know, combating racism, which is a big thing for these shooters. If you look at the profile of these shooters, people say there's no profile. Well, there is a profile. They're white, they're male, and they're between a certain age, right? They're usually teenagers or young adults. But if you look at the profile of their mental disability, it is very tricky because you can't say they're psychopaths. You can't say they're, they have antisocial personality disorders. But what you can say is they have an inability to communicate, an inability to problem solve on a real world level. So the film is very personal. The film is very much about the relationship between a mother and a son, the breakdown of communication between mothers and a son, which I personally feel is, you know, the root issue of why we have these, you know, atrocious acts of youth violence. Now, listen, I don't want to misrepresent the film. The film is not a PBS documentary about youth violence and the breakdown of communication. It is a psychological thriller that's very dark and disturbing. That is, you know, sure, it may be anchored in reality, but it is very much a horror. It is very much a thriller, you know. But, you know, I think there's a reason why, you know, films like Get Out and Parasite are winning Academy Awards right now, and that's because they're seated in real world issues and social issues, right? And I think that speaks to people. It's meaningful to people. So for me, that was the platform I wanted to communicate my message, and also just the experience of what is happening in America that we can have one mass shooting after another, one, you know, school shooting after another. What is happening?
Right. Well, and one of the things that I really enjoyed about the movie is that it really was kind of a dance around, is he going to go shoot some people, or is the mother projecting, or is the mother just projecting her own issues on top of the normal miscommunication and antagonism that happens between a mother and her teenage boy? So I'm just wondering if you had an answer in your head as to if that story had gone a different way, if he would have ended up doing it.
There are a lot. Listen, when I first wrote the screenplay, I had five different endings. And when I write, I like to surprise myself. I had five different endings. I sent it out to a number of colleagues, and all of them agreed. And I'm telling you, like 17 people agreed that the ending that I had sent them, because I also sent them an addendum which had the other endings. They said, no, this is the ending to go with. First and foremost, it's a thriller, right? It's a psychological thriller. It's a very disturbing psychological thriller, which to me is a great way to reach the subconscious of America, because right now, thrillers and horrors are really speaking to America. They like that adrenaline boost. They like the unexpected storylines. And sure, America likes the blood and gore. This film does not have a lot of blood and gore. I will say that originally it did, but Melinda Page Hamilton, who played the mom, said, "Do we need that? All of this blood and gore?" And there was a few things that we said, yes, we do. We do need that scene in the closet where, and I don't want to give a lot away, but where you realize that Jacob is pretty serious cutter, right? Well, being a cutter is an American problem. Sure, it's a global problem, but if you look at the statistics of cutters in America, it's really kind of mind-blowing what our teens are going through as opposed to what other countries' teens are going through. So I can't remember what exactly your question was.
The question was, if the story had gone a different way, do you have an answer in your head as to whether Jacob would have ended up shooting up the school?
Okay, yeah, got it. Listen, I think in this day and age, it is irresponsible to show the final act, what happens, a shooting in the school. I think it's irresponsible just because of what we know now about copycats. So at one point, I did consider it, but immediately my conscience said, no, you can't do that. You can't do that for whatever reasons. And then when I looked into it statistically, it's like you cannot, you know, glorify or sensationalize the act of in any way because you will inspire copycats. So very early on, I knew I would never have a scene where he did shoot up the school. And, you know, of course, the question, especially with the investors, became, well, how do you make a movie about a potential school shooter who never actually shoots up his school? And that was a valid question. And my answer to that was because it's much more personal than that, because it's much more complex than that. So it becomes much more about examining the relationship between the dysfunctional relationship between a mother and a son, which is not uncommon in this country. In fact, it's rampant in this country specifically. So no, I never did want Jacob to carry out the act of. And you know what's so interesting is that we never show him with a gun. We never show him loading a gun or contemplating a gun or looking up, you know, stats or facts of guns. But because of what we all know as Americans is such a crisis in this country of, you know, teenagers going into schools and shooting up classmates and teachers. It's, you don't have to do it. You don't have to show it. It's just suggested because we're all so acutely aware of what is happening in this country, you know, and right now, you know, listen, for the most part, schools are closed and they're slowly reopening over the next few months because of COVID. But, you know, we all know that when schools open fully, the next crisis after COVID is going to be school shootings again, right? Because it has been a crisis. When we were, you know, shooting the film, there were school shootings every other day. We had to take a moment of silence on set every time a school shooting happened. While we were filming, the Florida shooting happened. It was one of those things where we knew every time a school shooting happened, it was heartbreaking and horrifying, but we knew we were doing the right thing, even though it was, you know, it's disguised as a horror, you know, a thriller. But at the end of the day, it's something that we are all intimately aware of and afraid of, you know. And I think that goes a long way as far as the success and the message of the film, you know.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, go ahead.
I had a question. So while we're exploring the son, we're also exploring the mother. But I don't get into spoilers. What were you trying to bring to the attention of the audience when looking at her character?
Well, I think it's generational. I think it would be very short-sighted to assume that this was an issue that started with a teenage kid, right? It is generational. It's a generational lack of communication. And I tried to display that, to personify that with the grandma in the film, you know, Nana in the film, Abby's mom in the film. And of course, you realize, you know, early on in the first act that Abby, the mom, has some baggage from her past, right? Her brother acted inappropriately. And I don't want to give away any spoilers, but you know, her mom, Abby's mom, Nana, is like, oh, no, but it was this, but it was that. She's in denial, right? She's like, I don't think this is a problem for Jacob. You know, we don't want this to go on his record because it's going to affect his It's going to impact his, you know, his college applications, and we don't want this to go on his record. Well, as soon as you're talking about, I mean, that's cleaning up the crime scene, right? Unfortunately, that is something that happens quite a bit, where people are more concerned about the ultimate success, you know, college success, educational success, financial success of their kids, that they're not looking at, well, hold on, we may have a problem here. This kid may have an issue communicating. This kid may have an issue with aggression or whatever it is. So it is generational, and that is scientifically proven. So I did want to seed that in the film. I didn't want to, you know, make it a – I didn't want to make it a PBS documentary. I didn't want to make it about, oh, here's the profile and here's this or that. I wanted to make it a very personal relationship between this mom and this kid that I think a lot of us can relate with, you know. You know, there's a reason why there's the quote, you know, that art imitates life. The best art, in my opinion, imitates life. And that has very much to do with, there are horrors in our own lives, that to me are much scarier than the horrors we can invent, that we can, you know, the slasher films, although I do love a good slasher film, real life horror is, to me, is much more profound, is much more poignant, you know?
Now, you actually made a good point there, because, yeah, I mean, watching this film, the first thing you would come to a conclusion with is the son is going to be a shooter at a school. And you, like you said, you didn't mention that at all in it, in our inference, just for the fact of how common things of that nature happen, at least in the United States. But with the twist, or not twist, but Abby's issues, I was the biggest defender of Jacob up to a point. I was wondering if Abby didn't have her own issues, and you mentioned the miscommunication or lack of communication between parent and child, that when he acts out at the end and does what he does within the house, I'm curious if it was because he was the type of person that would actually go and be that quote-unquote shooter, or was it him acting out to the point where he's just a stupid kid that did something over the top and ridiculous, because at that point he was looking at his mother as an enemy and not someone that was on his side and I guess empathetic to his problems or his concerns. And this was his way to try to correct her to think how he's feeling, even though it was to the extreme of being, you know, criminal offenses that he did, like kidnapping, for example, or if not kidnapping.
A very brutal means of getting her attention.
So what? But my question is, I guess where I'm going at is, would Abby maybe be the reason he becomes who he is? Because had she knew what worked her communication with him better, maybe he would just have been, you know, the gloomy goth teenager instead of what we see happens at the end of the film. And by the end of the film, we find out that he doesn't actually kill anybody. So spoiler alert. So I'm just curious if, but again, you know, because of the breakdown of family, is it really Abby's fault as well too? So I'm just curious if Jacob was really that bad of a kid, or did he just have a child's brain that just couldn't understand what's right and wrong?
Right. That's a very complicated question there, Philip, but let's try to answer it, which is there is no handbook, right? There's no handbook to, you know, proper child rearing. And there's a lot of surprises along the way. And do I think that there is generational dysfunction? Absolutely. How could there not be? Look at our country. there are ramifications for a grandparents and a parents and then therefore a teenager's inability to communicate. And it's very much related. And so in this film, we did try to illustrate that as grandma, Nana, was very much in denial about what happened with her son, right, with Abby's brother. And therefore, Abby is in somewhat denial of what is happening with her son, Jacob. Listen, teenage boys hormonally go through a lot of things, go through a lot of changes. Does that mean that he is psychologically disabled, has a disorder? Not necessarily. I think it comes down to our inability to communicate. All of us are addicted to media, right? To Instagram, to TikTok, to Snapchat, Facebook, Twitter. And I think it has, you know, inebriated our ability to communicate in person, to deal with real life issues. And I think that that is a crisis that every family across America is dealing with, on some level. This family, very much like a lot of families across this country, absolutely is dealing with, okay, is it my fault? Is this just a hormonal teenager? Sure, he has hormones. He potentially could have a disability. I didn't want to hang my hat on this kid is a psychopath. This kid, has sociopathic tendencies. I want to hang my hat on it's a generational issue of the inability to communicate. It's a generational issue of, oh my God, my son's going through this. I'm going to leave him alone. I'm going to let him stay in his room and play his video games and talk to his friends on House Party and Snapchat. And I'm not going to interfere too much because I don't want to be the helicopter parent. Well, I think that we need a shift in consciousness about what parenting really means. And, parenting is a big responsibility. And I think there does need to be an authentic communication that happens between parents and their kids. And that's not happening. And unfortunately, the results of that are horrific. And the results of that are horror film worthy, in my opinion. And, listen, to me, the most poignant films, whether it's horror, drama, or whatever, I'm not a big comedy fan, but it's because we relate to that character, right? We can relate on some level to what that character is experiencing. Well, a lot of people, therefore a lot of characters, are experiencing a complete disassociation of communication with their kids in this country. And very sadly, but not entirely unpredictably, what's manifesting is youth violence, school shootings, mass shootings. Listen, shootings in this country, school shootings are just the tip of the iceberg, right? There's a lot of shootings happening in all of our neighborhoods, regardless of socioeconomic backgrounds that are happening. But we're all aware of it now as white people. We're all white, right? We're aware of it now because it's happening in our schools. It's happening in our white schools. So whatever it takes to get that dialogue going, to get that conversation going, to me is important. I didn't want to make a film about, we're not communicating in our family, in our generation, in our schools. I want to make a film about, holy shit, this is the horror that can happen when you don't communicate. And it's very much based on real life. It's very, very much based on the dysfunction and the breakdown of communication between parents and their kids,
Yeah. Eric.
Yeah, so I guess the end of the movie, and I guess by the end of the movie, I mean the scene that came after the credits,
the button.
I think we would try to keep spoilers, but I don't know if I can do it here. Because of things that were said previously in the movie, it would seem to indicate that a certain action was taken by Abby. Am I reading too much in there? Or I think you know what I'm trying to ask here. Did she take...
Wait.
the action we all think she was contemplating at the end of the movie?
Yeah, because at the end of the movie, she's looking up at something. So, and I think that's right. What's Eric questioning, because of what happened at the button scene at the after the credits. Did she look what she was looking up at? Did that happen? Is what I think you're asking, Eric, right?
What do you guys think?
Because I think, yeah.
Do you guys think it happened?
I
think it did, because earlier in the movie she says, "If you're watching this, this happened."
Yeah.
So that's why I think it
did. Right, right. And then Eric, when we were discussing it, you were questioning how that could work. And what I told Eric was is that, you know, like WordPress and various other software programs, you can schedule things to be uploaded at a specific time and date. So it could have happened, and it still could have been uploaded.
Yeah. Well, another thing, too, is that even if you tried to delete certain bits of information, they'll be floating around somewhere. I mean, it's hard to get rid of something once it gets out there.
I love you guys. You guys are awesome. I love that you guys are such guys. You're like analyzing it from like this tactical space. I love it. I freaking love it. So at the end of the film, there's a moment where of reconciliation or not, where something happens at the end of the film. Yes, there's a twist. There's a turn at the end of the film that might not be entirely expected. And did she do it? Did this happen? You know, I am leaving it up to you guys. I am leaving it up to the viewer. If you pay attention, not just for the ending, but for the whole film, the audio, I can't say the soundtrack, because listen, I love found footage films. And we did try to stay very true to the found footage format, which is there's not a music score, right? There's not music in the background that is prompting you to respond or emote in a certain way. Every bit of audio or music in the film is sourced within the film. And that's how I think it should be with found footage films. Because, of course, found footage films, you're not trying to manipulate the audience to respond or emote in a certain way. You are showing what is real. So we did try to stay very, very true to that format. We made a couple boo-boos. They're so, I think, arguably identifiable, and no one has identified them yet, so let's just put it that way, that I feel like, okay, we stayed true to the format, because when I look at some of these found footage films, I'm like, no, but they didn't do this. I hear a soundtrack. I hear all these sound effects that are in there that's not supposed to happen with found footage films. We didn't do that. But all of the music was recorded ahead of time. In fact, a lot of it was written and scored for the film, and it plays in the background as music Jacob is listening to, or as you know, audio that is playing out of the television in the background when Abby's having a particular moment with the camera. There, at the end of the film, there we do leave something up to the audience. We do leave it up to the audience as to whether this final act occurs or not. If you pay attention, really close attention. They're calling it a cult classic because, you know, on Facebook and Instagram, we have people saying, I saw it the seventh time and I got this from it. And so now there's a competition on Instagram saying, well, here's what I learned and here's the Easter egg that I found in the eighth viewing, the ninth viewing. And I'm like, wow, they're viewing it that many times. Like, there's a lot of good horror films out there. I can't believe they're seeing this film that many times. But at the same time, of course, I'm honored that they're seeing it this many times. They're getting that many things. If you are not entirely stoned or drunk and you watch this film and you're really paying attention, you don't have to watch it that many times but the absolute clue is in the audio, is in the audio track. And we designed this very carefully over, you know, not just 2 months or 3 months or 4 months, but just under a year to help subconsciously the viewer track what is happening. And so at the end of the film, there's a moment where the mom is looking up into the camera. It's very dramatic. There's all kinds of things happening. If you listen to the audio, you do hear a police siren in the
right
back. For quite a long period of time. It's not very loud in the beginning. We ramped it as we went. Does she do that final act? You decide. You decide if she does. I think if you are paying attention to the audio cues, you will realize that maybe she doesn't. Maybe she doesn't do it. But how could she not? How could she not, right? Which is what something that Jacob says earlier in his monologue. Like, how could you not do it? Why wouldn't you do it? You know, I'm wondering, why wouldn't you do it? So, I'm trying to be very careful to not give away spoilers. But we've only had a few people say, but what happens at the ending? We don't understand. Because I will tell you that when I watch films and you really cannot understand what happens at the ending, I am bothered by that. Because I don't want 100% of it to be on my own, interpretation. I do want there to be a suggestion of solution and resolve from the filmmaker. But I do feel like we have that in the film. But if you're paying attention, not just visually, but also, audibly, what is happening in the background?
Well, if you don't want to state a definitive answer, that's fine. But like we've said this about a number of movies that we've covered on the podcast, which is that it's okay if you don't give us the answer as long as you have the answer.
I have the answer, but I will give it to you. But I have to absolutely understand what you thought it was first.
Yeah.
I think she did it.
Yeah.
Same here.
Yeah. There was five of us that did the discussion, and I think we all agreed that that's what our thoughts were.
You're saying "we're" a lot there, Philip. What do you think? Seriously, what do you, Philip, think?
Oh, yeah. called out.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. I think what Eric said was correct, that if you are seeing this to, whoever's watching this online, then something occurred and I think that probably happened, because I don't think it would have been on the internet otherwise. So Eric has won me over. Yeah.
Philip, come on, Philip. All right, so Eric, so you have jaded the consensus here.
Apparently I am wrong.
Yeah. No, you're not. We've only gotten a few comments. I thought we would get more about, but what happened at the ending. And we have gotten a few, and our media team does respond with, let's not give it away here, but email us, and if you really – or join our newsletter or whatever, and we will tell you if you really do want to know. There were several different endings to the film. One of them was a scene where we had booked Gloria Allred to – play the lawyer of Abby, and what they were to respond to this terrible situation, which ended up unfolding at the end of the film. And we did, book some great talent, and in the edit, when we were looking at it all, it didn't ring. You know, when you, I don't know if you guys have made films, I assume that clearly you can analyze films very well. You had that gut feeling where you're like, feel like I'm trying to, pull one over my audience's eyes. Mm-hmm. If you have that feeling as a filmmaker, you have to think about it, and you have to think about, you can't underestimate your audience. And so every time I felt like we were underestimating the audience, of course it was then we have to shoot it this way and it's going to be more money and all of that. But it worked out, because eventually we got to the point where I'm very, very happy with the end of the film, where we do leave it up to the audience. Mm-hmm. There are audio cues that let you know when the sirens get so close and the act has not been done.
Right, right.
Is the act really going to happen? It's not like she reached up and was like, I'm going to do it now, right?
Uh-huh. Okay.
Because it was contemplation, dread, sirens increasing.
Almost like hanging in limbo.
Yes, which is how it should be as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
So.
No, that's a fair point, because you're right. If the cop, the sirens were rising, and they were coming to that house specifically for a call, then
even if it happened, they would have stopped it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's a fair point. Yeah.
So I'm not going to, if you want me to give you the answer, I will. But I'm not sure there is There, I have my answer, but, you know,
well,
I think it's fair
game. And that's really what I wanted to know, is if you had your answer.
Yes,
because I'm not even kidding, because we've analyzed movies in the past where, like, we don't know what the answer is, but we're pretty sure that the filmmaker did, so that's cool. Where it's a problem is we don't know what the answer is, and we're pretty sure the filmmaker never got there either. That's when it becomes an issue.
No, yeah, I can see that. No, I had my answer. I had my answer. In fact, I was trying very hard to disguise my answer.
Gotcha. Okay.
Well, now I'm kind of. I'm actually now thinking it didn't happen, Eric. Yeah. So I'm flipping
that's
off.
That's what she just.
Forth.
That's what she just told us, Phil.
Yeah. That's true. That's a good point. All right.
Keep up.
I'm a little slow.
I'm going to just pose a potential answer, which is, if it had happened, it would be, like, ultimately very negative, and where would we go with that? If it hadn't happened, if she had not done the act of, then there's an opportunity for her to share what she had experienced, which I think in the button scene after the credits, we do try to explore, which is all of her efforts are not for naught, meaning at the end, at the button
she's
scene,
helping.
You see another mom with another son who, by the way, just insider information, the son in that film is actually the musician who created all of the lyrics and all of the music and all of the recordings for the entire film. He wrote it all for this film.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was spooky.
That's
band. Neat. Yeah, they're incredible. When they first sent me their music, I was like, this is so aggro, and this is so like negative, and like there's swear words, like anti-gay and it's anti, and I was like, it's anti everything. This is perfect. We absolutely have to use this recording artist. And we used, you know, we used multiple recording artists in the film, but this kid was Spooky Bands was in incredibly insulting, which I thought was perfect. But at the end of the film, we do have that button scene where we realize all of her work, whether she does this act or not, all of her, you know, work was not necessarily for naught, because here's another mom at the end of the film listening to her lines earlier, where she's like, I'm 46, you know, 42 years old. You know, I'm from Ohio, and I think my son might be a psychopath. We see another mom digesting that, absorbing that, and you realize that regardless of what you choose happens at the end of the film, it was not for naught, because there's another mom here who's like scratching her head thinking, shit, am I that mom? Do I have that kid?
Right.
Which is, I think, very, you know, relevant, and very effective, yeah, and very profound.
Yeah. Abe, you got a question?
So when communication is a major theme here, how did you coordinate the two leads into how they would work together before shooting?
You mean Abby and Jacob, the mom and the kid?
Yeah.
You guys, the casting process, people underestimate casting for movies. And I've worked a lot in TV, but before I worked in TV, I worked in theater. And so I very much can recognize an actor who, you know, does the work, who has the good motivations, who makes those, you know, very, very creative and sometimes difficult choices about subtext and what they want in that scene. It's very complicated. And a lot of times, you know, there's different types of directors. I'm very much a performance director. I'm very much an actor's director, where I want them to connect on a very deep level what they're doing. So casting this film was much more difficult than the investors ever imagined. But for me, it was like, no, this is how you do it. This is, you've got to find the right person. I've done a lot of television. I've not, this is my first, you know, this is my, you know, first feature film. So the investors, who are very, you know, good at what they do, said, you have to find actors who are well known, because you are not. And of course, you know, as someone who's been in the industry for a while, I'm like, it doesn't matter if I'm well known, I'm good at what I do, or I look at my track record. Well, you know, unfortunately it does matter, you know, what you have done. And in the film industry, I've done nothing. So, you know, our main investor had said, you have to cast actors who have a name. And he was right about that. And, you know, Melinda Page Hamilton, who plays Abby, who plays the mom, was not an easy hire. meaning, you know, she's done a lot of work. I was a big fan of a lot of her work. She's done Desperate Housewives. At the time when we were casting, she was in Damnation. She was the assassin in Damnation, and I was obsessed with her. I thought she was amazing and powerful and elusive. So we had our producers reach out to her agent and her manager, and, you know, she's like, who is Tusia Lyman? You know, as far as I can tell, she's done a lot of, you know, television. She's not done a lot of film. And it's a valid question. So we had coffee and we met. But what I loved about Melinda Paige Hamilton, who plays Abby, is that when we did meet, she didn't want to audition. She refused to audition. God love her. And so we met for coffee. And she's so well-read that she showed up to our coffee date with a stack of all of the articles and you know, the different publications of the school shootings and what happened with, you know, the Sandy Hook shooting and all of that. And she had recognized a lot of similarities in the script from headlines that she had read in the news. And I thought that was such a profound connection for her to make, where it wasn't just about, oh, this isn't just a psychological thriller, right? This is grounded very much, anchored very much in truth. And a lot of what happens in the film is borrowed from the manifestos, the memoirs of real school shooters and their parents, right? She's so well read. She knew all of those articles. She knew all of those publications. So even though initially she had said, no, this is a violent psychological thriller, it's not for me, when she read the script, the screenplay a few times, she realized, but I'm seeing this, what I remember from the New York Times and what I remember from this shooting, what I remember from this shooting. And so we had this incredible coffee date early on where she said, I realize this is much more than a psychological thriller. This is very much anchored in and grounded in real school shootings and their parents and the relationship or lack thereof. So for Melinda Paige Hamilton, we had to work very, very hard to get her. We were also working on Molly Ringwald. Ed Asner plays Dr. Arden in the film, the therapist of Abby and of her mom. And we were looking at all kinds of actors for that as well. And Ed Asner's agents had talked with us. And, you know, Ed Asner has... You know, he has autism that runs in his family. He has a son who has autism. His daughter's kids have autism. So he has the Ed Asner Family Center that is set up that has a lot to do with, you know, with autism, but also just people with disabilities and providing people with the ability to, you know, have family support that supports the whole family with whatever disabilities that they're dealing with. And so I think Ed Asner was drawn to the script because of the mental health themes that are in the movie. And so he ended up, you know, playing Dr. Asner, and he did a tremendous job. And then of course we had the kid, you know, the kid who plays Jacob in the film, which we auditioned relentlessly for months to try to figure out who was that perfect kid. And of course it has to be somebody who, it's not just a hormonal teen, but somebody who can really embody what it's like to, you know, dance on that line of what is hormonal and what is usual, and also what is perhaps, you know, a telltale sign of somebody who has a sociopathic instability. So we auditioned probably 400 kids for the role of Jacob. And this one kid who was a no-name, Bailey Edwards, a no-name, kept rising to the top. And all the auditions, all the callbacks, all the chemistry tests, this one kid who didn't have a lot of credits, but he just had the talent, kept rising to the top. And we didn't know who he was at the time. And so we did all of these, you know, chemistry tests with him. And he kept surprising me. Like every time he came to a chemistry test, he delivered the material a completely different way, but it was always authentic, which was just, you know, as a director, it's like, ah, fantastic. He's surprising me, and yet he's still staying true to the material. And so at the end of the day, we had to make a decision between him and somebody else who had risen to the top. And our investor said, but, you know, this guy has a lot of credits. Everybody knows him. He's been on such and such. But this kid, Bailey Edwards, nobody knows him. Nobody will recognize him. He's no built-in fan base. So, you know, we have to go with this other kid. And I said, yeah. Okay. But, you know, when I went to sleep that night, I was like, but we can't. We got to go with this kid who surprises me, who is Bailey Edwards. And so we hired him. The next morning, the producers called his agent. We hired him. We brought him on board. And then at that time, once we had already given him the deal, he, you know, revealed to the producers that he did have a famous dad, and his famous dad was Anthony Edwards. And we all know Anthony Edwards, who was, you know, Goose from Top Gun, but also, you know, the star of ER and a million other TV shows. And we realized, you know what, this kid, Bailey Edwards, never, you know, tried to book this role on the merit of his dad. He booked it on his own skills, right? On his own ability to interpret the material and to process it differently every single time. And so, you know, when we offered him the role and the producers called me, I called the investors and I said, guess who Bailey Edwards is? And they said, we have no idea. I said, it's Anthony Edwards' kid. Like, this is the breakout role for Anthony Edwards' son, his only son. And they're like, oh, that's way better than this other guy we had lined up to take the role of this kid. So it worked out. You know, I do think I do think it's important to always follow your gut in you know, whatever capacity in life, whether it's casting or, you know, doing a podcast or whatever it is. I do think it's important to follow your gut about, you know, what you want to do and ultimately what you want to achieve. And, you know, I think Bailey Edwards brought a lot to the screenplay and to the film that I don't think anyone else would have been able to bring to it.
Nice. Eric, what do you got?
Oh, I thought you were next.
Nope.
You caught me off guard. I'll pass for now.
But I didn't bore
all
right, you,
that's
right?
Fine. Yeah.
No, not at all.
No, he just thought it was my turn to ask the question. So I do have a question. There's various scenes of where we discussed that Jacob is partly, I guess, ethnically, since it can be either ethnicity or religion, dependent on what people choose. But he's partly Jewish, you know, his great grandmother or something of that nature, or his Nana was half Jewish or something of that nature. And yet he has a weird fetish for Nazi memorabilia and things of that nature. And then he shows passive aggressive bigotry to his friend and whatever, and we debated in our discussion, you know, is that just him being a stupid kid again, you know, because people will collect stupid things, that, you know, they'll collect serial killer stuff, or they'll collect, like, this in this case, Nazi memorabilia, but then of course he says bigoted stuff too, and you know, we all look back now as adults and say, oh, that's terrible, but, you know, when you were a kid, We've heard that stuff before. I mean, I lived in an all Irish town, and I look at as Italian as you can get, and so I used to hear crap all the time. So, I was just curious: was that put in as somewhat of a red herring, or was that actually part of the building of Jacob as possibly someone with dissocial personality disorder?
You know, Philip. So it's one of those things where there are a lot of patterns in the profiles of these shooters. I can't say that there is a specific pattern that will therefore foretell someone who may or may not shoot up a school. But one of the consistent patterns is racism. In fact, I would say it is the most consistent pattern is racism. And whether it's, you know, anti-Black or anti-Semitism or whatever it is, from all of the research that I have done, all of the manifestos and memoirs that I have read across the board, that to me is the number one thing that always is there. I think there was one case where I couldn't quite figure out if there was a connection. But even, you know, for a while there, even for the Columbine shootings of 1999, I was wondering, well, wait a minute, these kids weren't necessarily racist. They weren't this. They were, and I was trying to make an argument for, well, racism isn't applicable in this case. And then I looked at the date of the Columbine shooting, and it was Hitler's birthday. And I thought, okay. So even if it's not clear to other people or documented, there are pretty recognizable patterns in all of this. So to me, you know, I don't want to say there's a profile, because really there's not. If you look at Sue Klebold's memoir, which is called A Mother's Reckoning, she was one of the mom of one of the Columbine shooters who inspired and informed my approach to this film quite a bit. Her kid did not fit the profile, which inspired the whole scene in the film where, you know, you see Jacob with his friends and being goofy. And she says, mom says, this is the fake Jacob. Sue Klebold's memoir informed that scene and that through line because, you know, her son, and I don't want to give his name, but her son, who was one of the Columbine shooters, got good grades for the most part, had friends. His teachers did like him. So he didn't fit the profile of being antisocial or being...
Right, but if I could interject, I think I read that they say that he may have had borderline personality disorder or even narcissistic personality disorder, while the other was the quote-unquote sociopath or dissocial personality disorder.
You're right about that. But listen, I mean, if you look at like the 10 main personality disorders, narcissism is, narcissistic personality disorder is one of them. But what teenage boy does not have narcissistic personality disorder? What teenager doesn't have it? You know what I mean? Like when you're a kid, the entire world revolves around you. And it's part of the parent's responsibility to help you understand, you know what? I come into the equation. So-and-so comes into the equation. Our sister, our brother, our neighbor, our politician, our HOA manager, whatever it is, you learn as a kid, but it takes a while. It takes a while, Philip, to learn that, you are not the center of the universe. But I think that we are all organically, naturally inclined to think we are the center of the universe as a kid. How can you not? Every kid is only thinking about themselves. That's how the consciousness evolves, right?
A great another part of the process, too, is finding yourself as well. Some people figure themselves out sooner. Some people find themselves on the back where they started because they think, I haven't figured out who I am or what is going on in my mind. And then later on, maybe towards college or something like that, they start to rethink everything.
Do you remember what it was that inspired you to rethink it or reevaluate it or see bigger than yourself?
Sometimes. I think there's certain, like originally, for example, for myself, I wanted to go into criminal justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing well in the classes and stuff like that. But the environment and how everyone viewed everything didn't really click with how I felt about it. And I found my calling with more of analyzing literature and writing and stuff like that. And that kind of also helped develop my circle of friends and stuff like that, and the people understood. But this was like I said in college, in high school. In high school, I thought I was going to be into culinary and stuff like that. I thought I was more creative, so I was kind of rethinking everything about how I was viewing where I wanted to go and what kind of person I wanted to be and stuff like that.
But who am I talking to right now?
Abe.
So Abe. But in college, in high school, you weren't thinking about your role in the universe, right? Your role in what could better or evolve us as a species, right? Abe in high school was thinking about Abe. That's what happens. That's natural for all of us to be thinking about our own selves, right? So whether or not you call that a personality disorder or narcissistic disorder, an antisocial personality disorder. It's much, much more complex than that, right? I think as human beings, especially as young adults, that's how we process. It's how we learn. That's how we start decision making, right?
Yeah. And
well,
Good.
I was just going to say, I was going to ask you what your thoughts were on that aspect of things, because it's come up in some of these stories in the news. You know, a couple of years ago, there was somebody that got a very light sentence for the act of rape because they didn't want to affect his future too badly. That's something that comes in this movie as well, that they don't want anything bad on his record so it won't affect his future. So I was just wondering, you know, if it's possible to give a brief summary of your thoughts on that. Do you think that people who are teenagers whose brains aren't fully physically developed are 100% responsible for what they're doing?
Oh, it's such a tricky question. It's a good question.
Isn't it though?
Yeah. But it's a question I think that is also posed in the film, right? Are they 100% responsible for what they're doing? According to who, right? So according to the justice system, at a certain age, you are responsible for your behavior. My personal belief is that how your child, even teenager, behaves has very much to do with what communication you have or have not had with them. They may not be able to ascertain, they may not be able to understand what the ramifications of their actions are. You know what I mean? I think that there are, there are exceptions where a very loving family, in fact, the Claybolt family, the mom of one of the Columbine shooters. If you read her memoir, I do recommend you guys read it. It's called A Mother's Reckoning. It's like the aftermath of tragedy or something like that. It's so, what's so telling in that film, which very much informed, I mean, in that book memoir, which very much informed my approach to the film, was that there was a couple moments in that memoir where she said, I did not know. And of course the scrutiny of moms is moms always know. They know if their kid's going to be a psychopath. They know if their kid is capable of acts of violence or murder. But they don't always know. And in Sue Claybolt's case, the night before the Columbine shooting in 1999, she in her bed, this is a very poignant moment in the book. She says to her husband, because they had two sons, and Ryan, her younger son who carried out the shooting, she had said to her husband, he's such a good kid. We did so good with this kid, with this boy. And then the next morning, he shot up Columbine with his best friend. She did not know. She could not recognize the signs. He does not necessarily fit the profile of the type of student or kid that does this, that, or the other. And to me, it was so telling, and that completely changed how I approached the screenplay. I mean, I rewrote the screenplay after reading that memoir and a couple other memoirs, but that was the one that, to me, I was like, wait a minute, maybe he isn't goth. Maybe he just blends in. Maybe he is good at school. Maybe he does have friends, just like Sue Claybolt's kid had friends. Maybe his teachers do like him. And the more I research the profile of these shooters, the more you realize there is not a profile. The only similarity is white, certain age, and male. And to me, that was just so telling of they come from all different, socioeconomic backgrounds, but they are white and they are young and they are male. And they have gotten to a point in their lives where they do not know how to communicate with people. And so therefore, they're taking out their aggression and their teenage angst by walking into a school with an AR-15 and mowing down an entire classroom. And to me, that is just mind-boggling, and it's so shocking to me that people, have trepidation about talking about it, because to me, even not as a parent, we have to talk about these things. And it doesn't matter if they're, seated or disguised as a psychological thriller that, gets big numbers and reaches the youth of America, of our viewers. To me, it's like, we have to talk about this, because if we just make it a political debate about, access to military grade weapons or, mental health, then it becomes a political it's politicized, right? It's a political debate, and therefore there will be no change because, you know, look at our,
right.
our government, look at our country. As soon as it becomes a political debate, but it's not a political debate. It's not. This is a bipartisan, nonpartisan problem. This is all of our families across the country, which are, you know, they're acting out because they do not understand how else to process the emotion that they're going through. And it's all of our responsibilities, whether we're a parent or not, or a politician or not, or a Democrat or Republican, we should be talking about this. And in this film, I did try to make it nonpartisan entirely. All of the theories of video games and over-medication and single, you know, family homes, mm-hmm. all of those theories are in this film. You decide. And to me, the end of the film where I tell you, you decide what happens with mom there when she's looking up in the final act of the film, which people think are so shocking. You decide what happens because we do decide what happens for the future of our society, you know, and we have to talk about it. We have to talk about it. It's not about
well,
political, you know, party you're with or any of that. It's a human problem, right?
Well, Tusi, I feel like I could talk to you for hours about this. You've been very generous with your time, and we've gone actually a little over what you had blocked out. So I think it might be a good time to wrap it up.
Okay.
Do you have any projects you're working on currently or social media handles you want to get out there, anything you want to plug?
You know, I'm working on a lot of big projects. I work for A&E and Discovery and all of them. But what I would, you know, personally like to plug is the film. It's a mom movie. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. And the more we can all talk about it, the better, as far as I'm concerned. I'm also, you know, listen, my favorite film is the horror film. You know, it's found footage, but I'm part of the, you know, hashtag horror fam. And so, you know, those people, and it's interesting, the horror family, the horror addict, the horror lover, horror art, they're the ones who are responding really, really incredibly to this film. And to me, you know, those are the people I want to reach because those are my family. So that is all I will plug. And who cares about the successes of my you know, money-making career?
Well, the horror community is really interesting. And I actually read an article that said that the people who watch a lot of horror movies are actually dealing with the pandemic a lot better than people that don't. Well,
interesting.
It makes sense if you think about it, because we've all watched, you know, a million zombie movies, you know, what happens when the person gets infected and you stay away from them and keep yourself out. Yeah, you know, we've seen
we
it
have
down in fiction. Played
the apocalypse.
Exactly. We were prepped for this. So, yeah.
Indeed. And also, if there's any other stuff that you would, that genre related that you think anyone that listens to this podcast would be curious about, you're always welcome back to come on anytime to promote whatever you're doing. So, and we definitely appreciate it.
I appreciate it. You guys are awesome, man. And I really appreciate you reaching out and supporting indie film and especially supporting indie horror, because as you guys probably know, there's a lot of people that are anti-horror, certainly anti-found footage. And I wish that we could just enlighten them in a compassionate way. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that you guys do and you're good at. So I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really enjoyed it. This is a conversation.
Me too. I'm glad all of you could make it, even though I can only see one of you.
Well, at least I didn't scare you away being the only one that you can see. So that's good. That's good.
Regardless of whether we're on air or not, or on a podcast or not, you're always welcome to reach out to me and ask questions, and I will give you the answers if you really want them.
Awesome.
All right.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I'll send you the link of the episode and the interview and all that when we put it up. It'll probably come out within the next 2 to 5 days, I would think. So.
Cool. All right. Okay. I hope I didn't swear too much.
Nope, not at all.
All right, you guys. Thank you. Have a good night. Good night, Boston. Good night, Massachusetts.
Good night. Bye. Nice meeting you.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Let's give our final thoughts about this film here, M.O.M., Mother of Monsters. Eric, why don't you start?
I really enjoyed this movie. If you are game for a found footage movie, I would recommend that you check this one out, especially since you can get it for free if you're a Prime member.
Yeah, very good. And Mike?
Yeah, I'll recommend it. Again, this isn't quite a sensitive topic. I would put up all sorts of cautionary flags, I think, when we did We Need to Talk About Kevin, although it does cover a similar theme. I suppose if you are very sensitive to the topic of mental health, then that might be an issue for you. But I think it's a well-done film. I don't think it is nearly as heavy a film. And again, entertaining is probably not the right word, but I did find it a compelling watch.
All right, very good. And Abe.
I did enjoy this film. I thought both two main actors really did a fantastic job. I think they really worked well off each other in creating this kind of chemistry of troubled mother and son. I think it does have a lot to talk about, and it's definitely at least a good platform for a conversation starter. It's got some pretty disturbing moments, and it's also really plays well with some questions and nice little reveals and payoffs as it goes along. There's a few little things here and there that don't really work too well, but they're very small. And I definitely recommend it if you enjoy psychological thrillers or dramas and stuff like that. It's a good film, and I'm really glad we got to talk about it. It was good, and we had a good talk about a conversation this episode. And it's available on Amazon Video. If you want to check it out, it's there. I'm not sure, as Phil said, we're not sure how long that will be, but if you get the chance, we'll watch it.
All right, sounds good. Once again, this is MOM, Mother of Monsters. Myself and Chrissy. So, Chrissy, go ahead.
I was just going to echo exactly what Eric said. I think if you like found footage especially, you're going to enjoy this one because it's a little bit different. I pretty much can echo just exactly what Eric said. I definitely recommend it. That's it. I'll keep it short and sweet.
Okay, and I forgot myself as well. It's a pretty good watch. Oddly, the second watch was much better than the first, even though the first was decent. The second watch, I really liked it more than I thought I liked it the first time. I would definitely recommend it if you like found footage horror films. Once again, this is MOM, Mother of Monsters, 2020 film, now available wherever VOD is, but Amazon Prime for sure. Starring Melinda Page Hamilton and Bailey Edwards as the two leads. Ed Asner's last film before his passing. Tasia Lyman was the director and writer. And it's there for you to check it out. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in. Let's talk about MOM, Mother of Monsters. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.
They caught me before I hurt you. I'm not fucked up, I'm just a patient.
Oh, you better take your pills.
But what's more fucked up than this nation? Who the fuck taught these doctors communication? I know they scared when I tell them about this hatred, but
told you to move me, do these pills abuse me? Stop watching violent movies, but that be all that the news be. What the fuck should I do when this rage starts to seduce me?
What do I fucking do?
Fuck it, just better shoot me. The blood selling like rubies. Mother's scared of they son. A number one song about running if they get gunned down. Pumped up kicks, better run now, kid. I'm a fucked up kid, we all fucked now, kid, yeah.
This ain't gonna stop, no, this ain't the last one. This ain't gonna stop when the teacher get a gun. This ain't gonna stop when they took me out of school. This ain't gonna stop when they put me on the nose, no.
What a shame, I'm ashamed of the human race. So I blow them right in their face to show them something, to say something. Yeah, all y'all mothers, you better say something. Yeah, something to get that change coming. Oh, if only I checked his room out, read some of his books now. Something we could've done now. Yeah, there's nothing you could've done now. Just tell Trump get all them guns out. You would think they wanna stop kids from killing kids, but isn't it just obvious their interest is business? Everyone can't win this shit, especially if a kid is dead. Killed by a kid you tried to fix just by giving meds. Look at Australia, they got a gun ban. Stop everything, did it with one plan. Looking at Parkland kids like they be Aryans. They the best therapists and they survived a terrorist. Y'all be fucking arrogant, this ain't what the parents did. These kids are American, they're raised on our heritage. And something that we did made them take their rage and carry it right into the skull with something they had to prove. Damn. This ain't gonna stop, now this ain't the last one. This ain't gonna stop when the teacher get a gun. This ain't gonna stop when they took me out of school. This ain't gonna stop when they put me on the nose, no. This ain't gonna stop, now this ain't the last one. This ain't gonna stop when the teacher get a gun. This ain't gonna stop when they took me out of school. This ain't gonna stop when they put me on the nose. This ain't gonna stop, now this ain't the last one.